Good morning, everyone. We're going to call the Government Operations Election Policy Committee meeting to order. We have a very full agenda today, so look forward to a good discussion and a good day in committee. With that, Representative Pugh, can I have a motion on the minutes, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move the minutes for March 29th.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes from March 29th. Any discussion of those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. With that, we'll get started right in on the action. Representative Hackbarth will take up House File 3208. And I will make a motion that House File 3208 be referred to the General Register. Mr. Chair, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill just simply adds to rules that we're going to allow blaze pink to be worn during deer hunting season along with blaze orange. It adds it to the rules for hunting in the state of Minnesota. This is something that the state of Wisconsin has just recently done. They got a jump ahead of us, and Governor Walker has just signed it into law in February. So we're just kind of mirroring the same thing.
Thank you, Chair Hackbarth. Members, any questions or discussion? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none, we'll go back to member questions. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Hackbarth, just a quick question as a lifelong deer hunter. Is that as visible in the deer woods as a blaze orange? Because while I'm never going to wear pink in the woods, I do want to make sure that I see other people who are potentially wearing pink in the woods, being the disciplined hunter that I am.
Chair Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Nash. Yes, there's been some studies done by the University of Wisconsin that it is as visible, and deer cannot see it as well as orange. There's a blue hue in the orange, in the blaze orange, and the blaze pink is less visible to deer. So I think it's actually a good thing to do.
Maybe you will be wearing pink, Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can confirm that I will not, but I do have daughters that may wish to bling theirs out, but just wanted to make sure that that was on the record, because I have gotten constituent questions, and again, myself being being a concerned hunter, I want to make sure that people who are wearing this. Now, does this have any degradation like blaze orange does over time? Some of the brightness of the blaze orange has been shown to degrade, and I'm just wondering if that was part of the Wisconsin study as well?
Chair Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nash, I don't know that. We wanted to have the professor that did this study come to our committee and make a presentation, but it was pretty expensive to bring him, so we did not. But we do have his study, and I have that with me right now. We wanted to ask him some of those questions, but it is more visible, or as visible as blaze orange, and less visible to deer, and we do know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Chair Hackbarth will give you the final word.
Thank you, members. I think that's about it, unless there are other questions. We did want to bring that professor in, but it was too cost prohibitive to bring him in. I could have gotten some more information, but we're just here today mainly to talk about the rules.
That's right. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 3208 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Next on the agenda, House File 2988, Representative Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I don't have a fancy pink hat like some people have. Sorry, you'll just have to put up with a regular bill here. House File 2988 is a very simple bill that proposes to ratify the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Administrator Plan. The administrators have an average, basically, about a 2.25% raise each of the 2 years. The total cost from biennium to biennium is about 4.8%. And I think this would go to state government finance next, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will make a motion that House File 2988 be referred to state government finance.
And with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch. Members, any questions to House File 2988? Seeing none, is there in the audience that wishes to testify for or against House File 2988? Seeing none, Chair Knobloch.
I would appreciate your support.
With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 2988 be referred to State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Knobloch. I think you have one more on the agenda, so we can go straight to that. House File 3255, and I will make a motion that House File 3255 also be referred to State Government Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I have one amendment, the A1 amendment, that has a few small contracts in it that we're proposing to add on to it. Some individuals came to me and said that there really wasn't a particular author that had introduced these contracts. They're small contracts. We didn't want to get them lost in the shuffle. One's the state residential schools contract for, I think it basically is the employees in Faribault at the academies. The second is the Office of Higher Education contract, and I'd appreciate if people would be willing to add the A1 amendment on to 3255.
I will move the A1 as an author's amendment. Members, any discussion to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Call 3255, as amended, then contains five total contracts. It contains the other three MNSCU contracts, which is the IFO, the State University Administrative Service faculty, and the State College faculty, so two-year and four-year faculty and other employees. And as I mentioned before, it also contains the State Residential Schools now and the Office of Higher Education, two small contracts with the amendments. Members, I know that you have materials that's been distributed in terms of the cost of these contracts, in terms of the average raise and some of the structure of the contract. I guess I know there's kind of a full agenda these days, Mr. Chair, with everything in deadline week here. I can go through them in detail, or I can just take questions from people. Do you have a preference?
You can walk through them. We're waiting on an amendment to be copied. So,
yeah, an amendment for this bill?
Yes, sir.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right. Well, in terms of, I guess, just briefly, in terms of the administrative and service faculty contract for July 1st, 2015, faculty receive a 1.5% increase across the board. July 1st, 2016, they get a 1.1% increase. For those who don't receive a step increase, say they're at the top of their salary range, they get an additional one-time lump sum payment of 3%. There are some incentives, merit pay in a few circumstances. For the IFO contract, it's 2.2%, a 1% across the board increase July 1st, 2016, plus a step increase of 2.4%. There's also a, the adjunct faculty, that whole area, those types of folks have received a lot of publicity in recent years in terms of not being paid very much for the work they do. They do have increases for adjunct faculty in these contracts as well. For example, underneath the Minnesota State College faculty contract, there is a increase of, I think it's 18, it's equal, well, not an increase, but the total, I think, is a 1.25% increase. And then I believe it would be $1,856 a credit. Well, it depends a little bit on the faculty member. You go to the state residential schools, it's 2.5% across the board, and the Office of Higher Education unclassified is 2% per year. I guess I'm kind of going through it quickly, members, because there is always, a great bit of detail in these contracts. I could get into talking for each of these contracts about what the co-pays are and the dental plan changes are and any number of details. I think, maybe what would be most pertinent to members would be if you look at the overall cost increase in terms of like biennial new money. The IFO is 4.03% increase in terms of biennial new money. The Minnesota State University Association of Administrative and Service Faculty is 3.3%. The Minnesota State College faculty is 3.79%. The Office of Higher Ed is 4.67%. And the State Residential Schools is 6.2%. That would be the increase, the estimated increase in biennial new money needed for these contracts. And so, members, I guess with that additional detail, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. We will take a few. We are waiting on one more amendment to make its way down here. Apologize, it wasn't in the packets. We'll bring that up. Is there any member questions while we're waiting? Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Knobloch, from 4 to 6% increase over the biennium, can you share with us? I mean, does this align with income increases that the state has experienced, households in the state over the, and is it for previous 2 years or for the upcoming 2 years? What are we looking at as sort of a benchmark and a guide for setting these salaries?
Chair Knobloch.
Well, I guess in answer to your second question first, it's basically for the biennium that we're in. So it's July 1st, 2015 to June 30th, 2017. And in regard to the other, I guess I don't have detail, Representative Runbeck, on, you know, in Minnesota what the average personal income increase or average salary increase would be. You know, you're looking at 2 to 3% if you look at the total cost here. I would think that so that you know, I guess you can depend, you know, there's a lot of different ways of measuring, you know, average salary, average hourly rate, personal income. I mean, how many hours is a person working? I guess there'd be a lot of different ways of looking at it. I think it's maybe easiest for me to just say you've heard the total percentage increase, and I guess people can make their judgment as to whether they think that's fair or not.
Representative Rumbeck.
Mr. Chair, how about this one? What did state revenues, how does it align with state revenue increase over the biennium?
Chair Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, I would say it is somewhat below state revenue increases. If you looked at the total amount of taxes that came in, you know, the last 2 years, how much they're increasing each of the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rumbeck.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member questions right now? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knobloch, I just want to underscore something that you mentioned when you were answering Representative Rumbeck's question. These aren't dollar-on-dollar increases that you're talking about for wages. These are packages, and I think that everybody in this room knows that insurance costs over the last several years have gone up, and those who would be in state or public employee are not exempt from that. And that is the number one driver of benefits right now, is the problems that we have with insurances, and people can make their own decisions about whether systems that have been put in place work or don't work, without mentioning a certain state agency that sometimes pops to the front of the newspapers. I will just leave it as such that costs are increasing, so it's not uncommon for us to see an increase in those costs that a private employer would see as well.
Well, Chair Knobloch. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, that is a good point to make out that, I mean, even if you had no salary increase whatsoever for any of these employees, to the extent that you've got additional health insurance costs, that would be reflected as additional contract settlement costs that would be shown in these statistics.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the amendment has arrived, and if I was the last committee I was in that they were they were into punishing a state state agency for failure to do something, if I was so inclined, I would having wasted our time and not having this here witness was clearly to you before the deadline, but I'm not going to go down that route. But what the amendment here is, I'm going to move the A2 amendment. And what this does is, in past years, all the ones that have been negotiated, we brought them forward in one package and voted on them once, and again, save time in committee. And what this does is adds MNSCU personnel, as the nurses, as law enforcement, as the AFSCME contract, the Residential School Education Association contract, the AFSCME contract with the Municipal Employees contract. Anyway, it's all listed out here. Adds them all in to line this up to what a similar bill is going through the Senate. Again, they're going to have to be matched up at some point, and that's what this does. Why don't we just take care of all of them at once? These have all been negotiated in good faith. They've all moved forward. All going to be moving forward through this committee, and it might save us some time here in deadline week. And so that's what my amendment does, is adds them all into one bill.
Chair Knobloch?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, members, I guess I would prefer that you not do this. I guess I don't have anything against the fine state employees that are in all these other contracts, but I don't believe it's true that we've always carried all of these together. I know last year, for example, I carried the four MNSCU contracts and the Minnesota nurses contracts and state law enforcement contract. I didn't carry these other contracts. I know that Representative Cornish is carrying a bill this year that has the Minnesota law enforcement contracts and a number of the AFSCME contracts, I believe, that are whichever division it is that's related to the prison guards. I think it's number five, but I guess I don't recall, though I should. And so I guess, you know, we have moved bills, multiple contract bills in the past. We're proposing to do that this year. I'm not familiar with all these other contracts that Mr. Nelson is proposing to add on to these contracts, and I believe there are other people that are carrying these other contracts, and so I guess I'd prefer if you just leave the bill as it is amended right now.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Knobloch, or Chair Knobloch, I know there's all going to have to go through Ways and Means that you chair, and at some point, to match up with the Senate, they're going to have to be put together. I would say we could do it now and move these forward. Again, these have all been agreed to in past years when we've had separate ones. Usually they're ones that were negotiated after the other bill was put in, and we have at some point have some merged them together. And I know sometimes we've done them separately, but I'm just trying to, in this short session, save us time and energy in committees so we can hear all the other bills that we have to get heard and move on from there. So.
Representative Joachim.
Oh, thank you, Chair. And maybe my question is kind of along the same lines, but I'm not sure if Representative Knobloch really answered it. Just wondering why, when we only have 7 weeks left, whose decision was it to split up these when we've done them in the past all together?
Chair Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, I guess as I mentioned, and as Representative Nelson mentioned, we haven't always done them all together. From my standpoint, I represent a large MNSCU university. I carried the four MNSCU bills last year, the four MNSCU contracts, and so I felt I would volunteer to carry them again this year. And so I drafted two bills to carry the four MNSCU contracts. Then someone came to me and said, gee, there's a couple of these other contracts that we don't have authors for yet, the Residential Academies, Office of Higher Education, would you be willing to do those? I said, well, sure. I mean, one of them is kind of related to MNSCU anyway, the Office of Higher Education. So I'm willing to do those. But there were other people that were interested in carrying other contract bills, such as Representative Cornish, the chair of the Public Safety Committee. And, you know, he was interested in carrying the law enforcement related contracts. And so I wanted to defer to him and so forth. And so that's kind of why we are where we are.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Knobloch, thank you for clarifying that for a little bit. I know I'm newer to the process, but I do know that the Subcommittee on Employee Relations does look at them all together, mm-hmm. and more often than not, they have been put together as a package. And I guess we're just kind of leaving the rest on the table for tomorrow for who is carrying the bills tomorrow. Is it Representative Druskowski is carrying the rest of the contracts in GovOps tomorrow, Representative Sanders?
Representative Cornish also has some.
Yes. Oh, thank you, Chair, and I'm sorry, I almost demoted you. That would have been bad. No, I'm just actually asking a favor today, and I would really like you to consider Representative Nelson's amendment, because I think we're starting to see a pattern of people playing political games with other people's livelihoods. And we have a bill before us in this committee tomorrow that does just that and has a lot of policy language along with it. And coming from someone I know who's put a bill together to ask for R&D to be left off a ballot initiative, off the ballots, I really would think that you, as the Ways and Means Chair, could pull this all together and save us a lot of time and a lot of discussion tomorrow, and accept Representative Nelson's amendment. Thank you.
Well, Chair, Representative Joachim, I guess you talk about something off the ballot. I'm not sure if I should ask you to yield, but I'm not sure. Are you referring to some bill or something that I have?
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Representative Nadbach, I'm referring to the bill that you carried to have the Republican and Democratic indicators taken off the ballot.
Oh,
Chair Nadbach.
Well, I guess I didn't realize that bill was somehow related to this. I guess we had that discussion in here before. I don't know, a lot of my constituents seem to like it. If people are interested in knowing the partisan designation of people, there's something called the internet that's out there that I think will allow people to get all the information they need. But that's not really the bill that's before us here. I guess I don't want to step on Representative Cornish, who is interested in carrying some of the law enforcement bills. I'm not that familiar with everything else that's going on with the other bills. Because I carried the Minsky-related bills, and I have a couple of big Minsky institutions in my district, last year I was interested in carrying them again, and so that's why I'm carrying them. And I guess I don't know the details of all these other contracts. I know they've been negotiated. I know there's, you know, a lot of great state employees we have that are in them. I'm not in any sense saying that I oppose the contracts by saying I don't want to carry them. I guess I'm just saying that I don't want to step on other people's toes that have already introduced those bills. And I got my bill, and maybe they'll be combined later, but I guess for now I'd appreciate it if we just keep my bill as it is.
Representative Nelson.
I'd like a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Any other member questions? Seeing none, clerk will take the roll.
Chair Sanders.
No.
Vice Chair Pugh.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Albright.
Nope.
Representative Fenton.
No.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Lane.
Yes.
Representative Mullery. Representative Nash.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Runbeck.
No.
Representative Seltzer.
Yes.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
There being 4 ayes and 10 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Chair Nadbach, to your bill as amended. Any final comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate people's support so that we can pass these contracts for the state employees who work for us.
With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 3255 be referred to State Government Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Nadbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 3470, Representative Vogel.
Yeah.
Smart man.
Do
over there, two over here.
How nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, sir. I will go ahead and move House File 3470 be referred to the Taxes Committee. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for having me in the committee. I think I was here once before, but I figured I'd better err on the side of caution and bring treats again so I wasn't criticized. I do have an author's amendment. You want to address that immediately?
I will move the A1 to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Any discussion of the A1? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. House File 3470 deals with franchise fees. And I came upon this reading a local newspaper, found that a neighboring community was looking at using franchise fees to, I don't think they ended up doing it, but to finance or use for the construction of a community center, which got me thinking, what are these things, what's going on? So after researching, found that the use was actually becoming quite common. And beyond just the direct cost of ongoing things that the utility may cost the city for being in the right-of-way or whatever. So after researching, found that the state statute refers to cost, which would be things like maybe use of the right-of-way, but it did not restrict it to just that. So it pretty much opens up franchise fees to being used for really anything a city would, most times a municipality would want to do. I also found that the public notification rules in the statute are very limited. I've not found cities that are being irresponsible with the way they're approaching these things relative to the statute that's in place, but it really, from what I could determine, didn't even mandate a public hearing. So not that they're not doing that, but just looking at cleaning things up so that people have more transparency. And also, I think the utilities are generally not in a position when a franchise fee is being discussed to speak against it. After all, there's a partnership between the utilities a lot of times, the municipalities, to make sure services are available. And the utility, although they're going to get stuck putting the fee on their bill, is not really going to have it as an impact on their bottom line because it'll be collected and passed back to the city. And most importantly, I suspected that most of the general public, the taxpayers, were not aware of the use of the franchise fees or that they were actually being used as a substitute for taxes. So I came to the conclusion that I could approach this in one of two different ways. First of all would be to look at restrictions and what they can be used for, which would be narrowing that maybe that definition to the use of the right-of-way or ongoing cost. But when I looked at that, first of all, I found it was going to be really hard to define. And secondly, didn't want to infringe on local taxpayers-citizens' right to use whatever method they thought was best to fund their local government. So decided to go rather with looking at transparency more so that people are more aware of what's going on. And what the bill does is allow citizens to be more fully informed. It allows them to decide how much and what methods they want to use in taxes. And it also ensures a process is available so that there is this transparency then codified in statute, because it's not a normal way for people that people would expect to be taxed. It does not show up in the city budget levy discussions unless you really look deep and see what's going on there. It can go on for a lot of years. Excuse me. It can go on for a lot of years without the benefit of public input or agreement, unlike the levy discussions and the budgets, which are annually reviewed. And to do that, to support that process, it puts in place a reverse referendum, saying that if a percentage of the taxpayers decide that they want it on the ballot, that everybody gets to decide whether or not this is a good idea to use for the city. It was heard as a draft in the property tax division before the session, which I used that to make some input changes because, again, it hasn't been something that's been addressed recently. And I did do a few of those, but nothing significant other than one of the things it did do was to alleviate the need for the cities themselves to have to send out by first-class mail a notice. It now allows the city or the utility to send out the notice so that there wouldn't be an additional cost if the city and the utility could agree on that. Other than that, I have two testifiers, one just to kind of briefly go over what's happening with franchise fees as far as the statute, and then the other just a few observations on the impact.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and I'm going to just take you through very briefly a PowerPoint that I actually presented to the Property Tax Committee when the earlier version of this bill was heard at that point, and you should have it in your packet. Just looks like this. Just to give you the highlights, franchise fees have been authorized by statute since the middle 1970s. There are two different statutes. One applies to cable franchise fees and one applies to the public utilities, which are the electric and gas. Cable franchise fees are already limited by federal law, and they're limited to 5% of gross receipts. There are no limits on the public utility franchise fees. They may be in any amount. They can be a flat amount per account. They can be based on chargers, or they can be based on units consumed. Revenues from both of these franchise fees can be used for any general fund purposes. If you go to the second page, the top of the second page just shows how the use of franchise fees has grown over the 40-plus years that they have been in effect. Initially, there were 23 cities with franchise fees. There's now 357. Originally, they raised $13 million. They now raise about 10 times that amount, 136.9. It used to mainly be used by large cities. In 1975, Minneapolis and St. Paul accounted for 86% of the amount of franchise fees raised. Now they only account for about 44% because there are so many cities that collect it. 163 of those cities are what we consider small cities in this state, cities with population under 2,500. Although there are a lot of them with a franchise fee, they are not the majority of the money. They're only about 2% of the money. This is a collection mechanism that is used by cities both in the metropolitan area and in greater Minnesota. So it's not a metro versus non-metro issue. And the slide on the bottom of page 2 actually shows you how the number of cities imposing franchise fees has grown over time. And if you go to the very last page, it also shows you how the revenues have changed over time. And there's always questions about that up and down thing that occurs in the middle 2000s. And that has to do with the fact that utility fees, as I said, can be based on units, or it can be based on prices, or it can be based on accounts. So those numbers can change depending on what's going on in the economy. I cannot separate out the amount of franchise fees related to cable versus the amount of franchise fees related to public utilities because the cities do not report that information broken out to the state auditor. And with that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I think what we'll do is we have several other individuals on the testifiers list, so we'll continue to go through there, and if we have questions, we'll call you back up. Mr. Carlson. Well, I have Gary Carlson, Scott Neal, Justin Femright, and Lori Higgins on the list.
Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind, could Ms. Higgins testify?
Absolutely. She happens to be a constituent, so of course.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
To the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Lori Higgins, and I'm the president of the Metro North Chamber of Commerce, which represents about 700 businesses in the North Metro and Opequon area. So thank you for this opportunity. The Metro North Chamber has long opposed franchise fees, and I want to take a few minutes to tell you why in respect to the legislation before you today. First and foremost, franchise fees are not a transparent cost of government. Taxpayers are literally in the dark as to who is really collecting this fee, oftentimes assuming it is the utility, since it's on their invoice, and the taxpayer sends the money to the utility, which of course in turn reimburses the city. That specific transfer of government-mandated fees are not clearly explained to the taxpayer. Further, there is little of any transparency as to for what purpose the franchise fee is used. While a city may begin the process of establishing franchise fees for a specific project, like to fix a road, once initiated, the collected monies easily become an expected part of the city's revenue stream to be used in perpetuity. In fact, to further emphasize that point, a business owner recently told me that in a discussion with a city official, it was remarked that the city would have to cut staff if their franchise fee were eliminated. That's ironic, considering that that business alone is paying the city $40,000 a year in franchise fees, which they could have used to hire an employee, grow their business, and contribute to the local economy. Finally, on the issue of transparency, there is very rarely widely shared information to residents and businesses when the issue is under consideration. Already twice in the past year, I have received notice at the very last minute that the franchise fee issue was scheduled on a council agenda for testimony and public input, but only to have the issue be too far down the road to really make any difference in the eyes of the policymakers. Requiring legislation mandating greater communication by the city to allow taxpayers a better chance to provide feedback much earlier in the process is not only common sense, but it also benefits the greater good for the valuable relationship between a city and its stakeholders. Additionally, providing the opportunity for a citizen-led referendum on establishing a new fee so it goes before all voters also fits an inherent part of the democratic process. Besides the critical concern of governmental transparency, these franchise fees negatively impact job growth and business expansion, especially among high-energy users, and specifically large commercial and industrial companies. These businesses pay solid wages and benefits in the communities where they reside, and they are the very engine of the American economy. Without growth and expansion, this in turn hurts the city from economic development consideration. As an example, the city of Coon Rapids charges 4% of their utility bill for the city-required franchise fee. This 4% utility surcharge collectively aggregates into a substantial amount. One employer pays $60,000 a year to the city just in a franchise fee mandate alone. That's revenue off of their bottom line that they must find ways to offset, either through more sales or less expenses, that can and will affect their decisions to expand. $60,000 in franchise fees is certainly the equivalent of a decent paying private sector job. A locally required franchise fee is definitely something a business looks at when looking to relocate. This legislation is a good first step to require greater openness by city officials considering a franchise fee, and I respectfully urge your consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Neal, Mr. Femray, who's up?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to first thank Representative Vogel for discussing our concerns with his bill between the time of the first hearing in the Property Tax Division before the session began and today, and we're going to continue to work with him on the bill and some of our concerns with the bill. Let me just say that we understand and appreciate the issue that he's trying to address, the issue of transparency and making sure our citizens understand what we're doing. And with me today, I have two city representatives that have recently gone through the process of instituting franchise fees and successfully done so. And I should have thought about this before I came today, but I should have probably brought a city or two in where the citizens told them, no, we don't want to do a franchise fee as well. And maybe if we have another hearing on this bill in another committee, I could bring in some cities that decided with citizen input that they didn't want to do a franchise fee. But with me today, Mr. Chair, is Scott Neal from the City of Edina. He's the city manager, and Justin Femright from the City of Elk River. He's the city engineer. And I'd like them to describe the process by which they impose the franchise fees, and they included citizen involvement and information about the uses of those fees.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Neal. I'm the city manager in Edina. My city imposed its first franchise fees in 2013 following a great deal of discussion about franchise fees off and on over a number of years. The franchise fee discussion for my city came out of the desire to respond to citizens and and their desire, their expressed desire on a number of occasions for a new funding vehicle for sidewalks and trail improvements in the city. Up until that time, those projects had been funded either through special assessments or through property tax increases. People wanted to have sidewalks, but they wanted the cost of them to be spread across the entire community. So that's where the franchise fee discussion started. We adopted our franchise fees in 2013. They were imposed later that year. There's a great deal of discussion anytime you adopt a franchise fee with the utilities that are going to levy these franchise fees on customer bills. They want to make sure that gas is treated equitably compared to electricity. They also want to make sure that inside internal equity from their small customers to their large customers, there's some equity internally as well. So we spend a great deal of time talking about that, talking about different models of how those fees could be structured. They are structured after they are structured, they are put into an ordinance form. That ordinance is considered by a city council. Different cities handle that in different ways. Our city has two readings and there's a public hearing in the middle. In this case, there's an additional statutory requirement that there's a 60-day notice between the first discussion of an adoption of a reading and the second reading of the ordinance to allow the utility time to build that into their rate structure and to schedule it in front of the PUC. So we had a number of opportunities there from the first reading of the ordinance to the second reading of the ordinance, 60 days in between and even 60 days ahead for residents and citizens of the community to express their feelings about utility franchise fees to us. In our case, we made the case pretty effectively that we were using these for special assessment relief and for property tax relief, and so there was a lot of support for franchise fees in our community. Those franchise fees have been in place now for about 2.5 years. They raise around $1 million a year. We imposed we increased our franchise fees for a new purpose to create a new capital improvement program for sustainability, conservation and sustainability programming and capital improvements in our community, which added 50 cents to the existing utility fee. So our existing current rates for our franchise utility fees are $1.95 per month per utility per household. So that's where we are today. There's a lot more detail to it than that, but I'll ask Justin if he wants to chime in too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Femright. I'm the city engineer for the city of Elk River. We began looking at the option of collecting franchise fees as a revenue source, also to move away from 429 special property assessments and tax levy for street reconstruction and pavement management purposes. We first started reviewing this in 2012 with our city council. We had about 5 different work sessions with the council where we evaluated different opportunities and different options for funding our pavement management program long term. At every one of those, we looked at our existing program, what there were for other options, and the council continued to steer us towards the idea of the franchise fees. It wasn't until 2013 that it ultimately came before them through a public hearing for implementation. Ahead of that, our communication process and our transparency process to see what the community's flavor was around that was, we sent out mailings. I apologize, I don't have mailings enough to go around to the entire committee, but to all property owners, explaining exactly what we were considering, giving some estimates on what our franchise fee was going to be. In addition to that, we did work with our Chamber of Commerce directly parallel to this process to get the word out to our business community. A lot of times they aren't necessarily the property owners, so again, going through a different avenue, working with our downtown business group to get the word out there on exactly what we were proposing. Ultimately, we had enough community support through, you know, what's allowed in the statute now and through what we did to move ahead with collection of franchise fees for covering 100% of the costs of our pavement restoration needs. We collect about $1.4 million annually between the two utilities in which we charge the franchise fee on, and we have had overwhelmingly positive support from our community, both businesses, property owners, residents alike, on how much more efficiently and effectively we can deliver a street reconstruction program and pavement management program to them, no longer needing to levy special assessments, bond for, or borrow money to cover those costs. We collect it ahead of time, and we pay cash from our franchise fees as we move ahead with our program. So with that, I'd be open to any questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll move into questions and discussion. Members, any questions or discussion to Subdivision 2, which is the jurisdiction of our committee? I don't see any Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Chair. Just a clarifying question, I guess, for the author. Thank you, Chair. Representative Vogel, with the amendment, it went on so fast. I just want to make sure I understand it. So you changed the 30-day requirement to 90 days now that a citizen has the ability to do a reverse referendum petition?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, and after looking at and some of the comments I got back after the draft discussion was held at the property tax, the 30-day seemed to be relatively short to gather a number of petitions. So what I looked at was the time period between what would typically be a city's process on their truth and taxation, which is pass the preliminary levy by September 15th and have your TNT sometime middle of December, which is about 90 days. So I basically just matched the 90 days there to that process to this process.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Chair. And then to the testifier, I am so sorry. I didn't quite get your name, the one that went through this entire lengthy process with the public. What was it? Could you
Mr.
repeat
Femray.
Your name, please? Mr. Femray. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Femray, how long did this whole process that you spent time with your constituents to make sure they were comfortable with this take for you?
Mr. Femray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we probably spent, by the time the council steered us towards franchise fees, we probably spent about 3 months on public engagement and public involvement to gain their interest. And we did everything from a blog on our website where I would facilitate discussion, answer questions, understanding that the public hearing process itself is not very effective at gauging the entire acceptance of a community now. You know, we get a few people that come and speak, but you know, we're using new avenues. And right now, as the statute sits, it kind of allows us to use all of those avenues and gain that interest. So,
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Femray. I applaud you for going through that public process. We did have lengthy discussions in property tax and local government on how that public process could actually be stifled if you went just to a public hearing requirement. So thank you for doing all that work.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have some questions for Pat Dalton, please.
Ms. Dalton, if you would, make your way back to the table. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dalton, I'm not sure if you want me to rapid fire them, but I have three for sure written down, or do you want to do them one at a time?
Ms. Dalton.
My memory is not, Mr. Chair, Representative, my memory is not what it used to be, so why don't we do one at a time? Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, do the fees sunset ever, or is this something once it's started, it goes on forever?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's no requirement in law that these sunset.
Representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton. Is there any reporting that happens once, I know we're talking about what happens to get the franchise fee in, but once the fee is set up and if it goes several years or many years, is there any reporting that's done? I think we heard where, you know, maybe the purpose of the fee is changed. Once one goal is achieved, then they can switch it to another.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's nothing in the statute that requires that. I have heard anecdotally that a number of cities, you know, will make, you know, have informational hearings, but there's nothing that requires it. And the only reporting on it at all is what shows up in the state auditor's report that's required.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dalton. Yay, you were at number three. Do nonprofits pay this as well?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe they do.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Dalton, for this great presentation that you pulled together. I mean, I really, it's just excellent. And as I was taking a look at, on I think the second slide, I see that there are 101 cities in the metro. And I'm wondering if there's a single source that a member could go to identify which of their cities I represent all are part of 10 cities around Lake Minnetonka, and I really am not aware. I have a couple of concerned constituents about this subject matter. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I actually do have a list and a list of when individual cities impose these. Though I could actually get you a list of all the cities based on the state auditor's reports.
Mr. Chair, very good. Thank you so much. I look forward to getting that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have just kind of a narrative that either the author of the bill can help me understand or for the city administrators, but Representative Vogel, I'm looking at lines 2.21 of the bill through lines 2.25 or 2.6, and the line of questioning goes to the understandability of a city and how they go about addressing on either a tax statement or the disclosure in terms of what minimal requirements would a city need to meet in terms of how to describe what costs constitute a defrayal of their costs.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We worked on that language because we didn't want to get too specific and limited to certain things. What this revision after the draft did was to have the entity, the municipality, set up two separate accounts. One where they could directly allocate the ongoing cost of having that utilities equipment either in their right-of-way or in burdening to some extent their overhead cost. So that would be one account. The other account would be where it's being used for something completely unrelated, really, to the use of the right-of-way that the utility is doing. And it then addresses also the way those accounts can be administered. So, therefore, if that cost account tends to run a surplus, it addresses that as well, so that those two things are segregated. As far as the direct cost, that was going to be really difficult to totally hone in on, so it's one of those things that probably would have to be picked up and audited as to whether or not they're following state statute.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. If a reverse referendum were enacted by the citizens as described in the bill, could they request a reversal of only one of those accounts?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, from my reading of this, I would say no, because if you're going to have a franchise fee going forward, you have to be specific as far as whether it's actually a cost allocated revenue source or whether it's an ancillary source going for something else.
Mr. Chair, I just have one follow-up.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then Representative Vogel, as was asked by Representative Tice in terms of the sunset clause, if it is for a project specific, would it not be necessary to put a sunset completion clause on the account and or what would happen to the separate account once the project account is completed? What would happen to those fees in the other account.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I didn't address the sunset in here. It does address that if there is a sunset, that this process has to be followed. So if indeed a municipality has an existing franchise fee and it would expire relative to the original ordinance, they would then have to follow this process to redo it. But I did not address the expiration of existing fees that don't have a sunset.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel, you know, for bringing forth the bill. I know it was done in the spirit of transparency and, you know, informing our citizenry, and that those are all good things. However, as a former locally elected official myself, and hearing the descriptions, you know, I understand when there's any going to be any type of new revenue or big change, you want to engage your citizens up front. And or you won't be there in that capacity to engage your citizens later if you're not transparent. And so as I looked at this and I listened to you know, Ms. Higgins' testimony and the fact that she was concerned that, you know, on the bill itself, you know, the source or the origin of the franchise fee may not always be laid out clearly. I'm wondering, as we look at all of this, and then as I heard what our locally elected officials are doing before they impose a franchise fee, I'm just wondering if instead of all of this, if it might not be something to consider that we simply would require that on the bill there'd be some clarifying language as to the source of the franchise fee. Our citizens are very intelligent and informed and engaged across Minnesota, and if, you know, they had a question about something, I'm sure they would contact their locally elected officials.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, as I got into this, I had thought, I said, like I said initially, about even restricting franchise fees to the actual cost, and that became really something I didn't want to go into, because it wasn't about restricting the local government and their citizens to choose how they want to be taxed. But the idea of the public hearing is because, and the reverse referendum potential, is because once these things are imposed, they tend to stay. And we have Truth in Taxation that every year reviews our levies. Once these things are there, they're there. So I looked at this as a special kind of tax that once it gets there, it tends to stay there, and I don't disagree that it would be good to have some type of notice on the utility bill, but I also didn't want to complicate this any more than I had to, because as I dug into it, I found out it's obviously a very complicated issue, and to try to describe all of those different things, which, you know, maybe sometime later would be a reason to revisit this again, especially when it hasn't been revisited for 30 years, to at least bring some transparency to the process that imposes them because of the broadened use of them. So I recognize it doesn't necessarily maybe go quite as far as it could, but it, to me, it was at least a measure that could bring transparency to the process of putting them there, and then if some future legislature decided that maybe there should be a little more transparency, we could look at that.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel, for that explanation. Maybe I wasn't clear, and I won't belabor it, but my thought was to kind of scale back a little bit, not to add more, but thank you very much.
Thank you. Seeing no further member questions or discussion, Representative Vogel will give you the final word.
Well, just again, I'm sorry.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. Sorry, I really have not had enough coffee this morning. It happened at the other committee, too. I'm just trying to, clarify with something one of your testifiers, Ms. Higgins, said, too. This is a fee that's being charged the utility, right?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Vogel, and it's the utility's choice to pass it on to their customers.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I guess it is their choice, yes. It would obviously be an another rate burden, though, whether it's passed on or not. If the utility does charge it to the customer, it actually is increasing, of course, their utility bill. So whether they chose not to pass it on or not, the customer would still see an increased utility bill, because the money is going to have to be paid to the municipality one way or another once the fee is imposed.
Representative Joachim.
Chair Sanders, thank you. Representative Vogel, from my recollection, most of our bills in our house we do pay straight from the bank, but we still get the statements. On the statement, it does say franchise fee most of the time and most of the utilities, right?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe it does, but from what my reading was, it doesn't prescribe really how the utility has to disclose this. So they may choose to put different wording on different bills. And again, I didn't want to go there because I figured this was a complicated enough issue to just address from the imposition standpoint.
Representative Joachim.
Chair, Representative Vogel, maybe next year together we can work on that in show of transparency. Also wondering, and maybe this is a question for Ms. Higgins, I'm not even sure, and it's probably actually going out of, we should have asked it in taxes. Are businesses able to use this franchise fee as kind of a cost of doing business and being able to write that cost off?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not a tax accountant, but...
This is going to taxes next.
Yeah. If it's a legitimate business expense, I would presume that a business would be writing it off. Unfortunately, if you're a consumer, you wouldn't be able to use this relative to your property tax refund, though, I don't think. Again, I'm not an expert on this, because it's being charged as a franchise fee on a utility bill rather than a property tax that would show up in the general levy. But I'm not a tax professional.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Nash to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel, Representative Joachim, these do get passed on to the resident. It is something that, from experience, goes straight to the resident, straight to the consumer. And, you know, it is very clear on the bills, at least that I saw, that it is passed on. It's, you know, is it the cost of doing business? I would argue not if it shows up on my bill. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Any other member questions or discussion? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vogel. I just wanted to comment that I really believe the best way for cities to go with a lot of these things is transparency. Every year, on a 7,500 square foot building on 1.67 acres with its own utilities, by that I mean we had our own well and septic, and paying $9,000 in taxes, I also had to pay a stormwater fee, and I also had to pay for streetlights, both of which were at least 3 miles away. We didn't have cable, and we didn't have all that. I didn't know what franchise fees were. And I think what a lot of us are okay with doing is, I'm okay with paying it as long as I know what it's for. Tell me what it's for. Tell me how long you're going to do it. If you want to switch the purpose letter later for the account, that's great. But have that discussion. I'm on the Transportation Infrastructure Advisory Board at the City of St. Cloud, and we helped promote a levy, and that was to play catch up on some of the street improvements that we hadn't done for a long time, and the levy passed. But what we really wanted to make sure is folks were really informed on what they were doing. What they were voting for, that it wasn't increased to their taxes, but we knew about how much it would cost. So the greatest gift I think we can give to everyone is just the transparency of knowing what these fees are. And I know a lot of these happen, and the reason for the question about nonprofits is it's a way to get some money into the community from those that don't pay property taxes. I get that. But on the other hand, I who didn't even have the services got to pay for it too. And that's really frustrating when I make phone calls and say, why am I getting charged for stormwater? And the comment is to pay for wages of the guys who work at the plant. And that is really frustrating. And for me, I just want to know for sure where it's going. And I'm all for transparency. Be honest about where it's going. Tell me what's going to happen, how long you're going to do it. I think those are just common sense things that we would expect from any business person. Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. I promise this is the last thing. I just want to say, Representative Teese, I agree with you on the transparency. It has to be there. This bill doesn't get there. This bill allows citizens to just do a reverse referendum so that the franchise fee doesn't go on. So this isn't giving any added transparency on the fact on franchise fees that have been imposed in the past. It's just going forward and allowing a reverse referendum to go on. So maybe we need to work on a bill that does what Representative Teese is saying in the future. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vogel, final comments.
Thank you. Well, to me, the bottom line is here, there's been a statute in place since the mid-1970s. It's 30 years old. It has evolved greatly from where it started. I think it will continue to evolve. This is not an attack on cities. It's not an attack on cities trying to raise revenue to pay their expenses. All it is saying that is because it is a special kind of tax that never seems to be known by the public, that we put in place a process to address it right at the start so that people are fully aware and have the right to say yes or no. And with that, I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3470 be referred to taxes as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Vogel. Next on the agenda, House File 2683, Representative Kreisha. While he's making his way down here, I'll go ahead and make a motion that House File 2683 be referred to the General Register. Representative Kreischer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the bill that you have in front of you, you've heard before, and it's just a renewal of an effort of extending the Child Protection Task Force, a task force that has been very, very beneficial and has allowed us to talk about issues that are very sensitive, that are very hard, and allows us to get away from rhetoric and really get into how we can get to solutions. And what I'm asking here is to increase the members, because the more people that I have that know about these issues, the better it is for us to recommend solutions and to try to find ways to improve the situation. So that's the bill that we have in front of the committee, and I would appreciate your support.
Members, are there any questions? No. And are there any members of the public that would like to speak to this bill?
My mother said it's a good bill, Madam Chair.
Very good, Representative Kreisha. Do you have any final remarks?
Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Well, then we are going to renew the motion to send your bill to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, your bill is on the way to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I look for your support on the House floor.
And Representative Franzen, we're ready to hear your bill.
Good times.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Franzen.
Yes, hello there, everyone. So, what we have here in front of us is just a nice little bill about eyelash extensions.
So I'd like to move your bill, and let me find it here. And we're going to be moving your bill, referring it to state government finance.
Yes. And we have an amendment.
Do you have an amendment?
Yes.
So I'd like to move the A16. And would you like to explain what that does?
Yes. So the amendment includes a 14-hour training compromise with the Institute of Justice and the Board of Cosmetology, as well as a stay in enforcement of new rules on eyelash technicians. We don't exactly know what the new rules yet, so we would like the legislature to evaluate them once we get back into session next year.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, everyone who agrees or approves, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, so your bill is now in the shape that you would like it in. And would you like to go over your bill?
Yes, so members, I've got with us Ms. Brenda Tots from the great city of Alexandria, which is easy to get to and hard to leave. And here today to explain, some of you maybe not know what is an eyelash technician? What are these eyelash extensions? And why is she here today? So, Ms. Tots, if she can do a little testimony.
Ms. Tots, if you would just state your name and for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
My name is Brenda Tots. And 10 years ago, I started a business doing eyelash extensions in the state of Minnesota, in Alexandria, and have been doing them since. I opened up a shop about 5.5 years ago, almost 6. And when I started this, there were no regulations in the state of Minnesota for applying the eyelash extensions. And since then, now the board is redoing their rules and is requiring someone to go back to school to either put in 1,550 hours or 600 hours. And there is no specialty license to apply eyelash extensions only. And so we're looking to have a license for that service only so that I can continue working in my business.
Representative Franson?
Yeah, indeed. So I just was like, well, you know, I made some phone calls to some schools myself to see how many hours, if somebody wanted to go just for eyelash extensions and get training, was that possible? And the answer was not so much. So one school said, yeah, we don't offer just an esthetician license. You'd have to do the entire cosmetology program, which was 1,550 hours, and they did not do, they didn't really touch on eyelash extensions unless you went above the 1,550, and then maybe it was a day or two of just the applications and some basic safety issues there. So, you know, I did not think that it was exactly feasible for women that have already been having their own business, doing this as a profession, to have to go back to school for 1,550 hours and then some, thus closing up their business. And so the Board of Cosmetology and I and the Institute of Justice came up with some compromise language, which is in front of us here today, creating a specialty license. And then women will be able to continue working their own small business without being burdened by the over-regulations of government.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Members, do we have any questions? And are there any members of the seeing none, or are there any members of the public that would like to comment on this bill? Okay. All right. So, Representative Franson, I renew your motion to refer your bill to State Government Finance.
No.
Oh, no. In a holding pattern. I wasn't sure that was... Oh, okay. Scratch that to the general register. As amended. So members all in, all agree? Say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? It goes on its way to the general register.
Thank you, members.
Okay. Representative Albright, next up.
So, which bill are we doing first?
2104. Okay. Representative Albright. We will be hearing House File 2104.
Thank you, Madam Chair. and members. House File 2104 has been heard in a couple of committees prior to arrival before you today. And Madam Chair, I understand that there, as part of the parliamentary procedure, in subcommittee we actually did adopt an amendment to the bill itself, and I'm just wondering whether or not it needs to be engrossed onto the bill at this juncture.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Apparently we will be adopting the committee report. So if I could ask all members who are in approval of adopting the committee report to say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Okay, so...
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Thank you. For my benefit, what was the committee report? Do we have that in our packet? Is that the... I'm just a little lost on where we're going.
Yes.
Is that...
Yes. And yes, Representative O'Driscoll. I do believe that is the CE... H2104-1.
And Madam Chair, if I might just elaborate for the benefit of the
committee. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the members that were not in attendance at the subcommittee that Chair Runbeck hosted, what the amendment that was offered in committee actually amended the membership of the Blue Ribbon Commission with the descriptive that starts on, I believe, and Ms. Dyson can correct me, on line 2.33, concluding on line 2.35.
Yes.
Do we need to adopt the committee report? Is that where we're at? Sorry. We're adopting the committee engrossment. Okay.
All right. With that, members, we're going to adopt the committee engrossment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Committee engrossment is adopted. And then, let's see. You also have an amendment to this? The other one. Perfect. Sorry, I stepped out of the room for a minute. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. We don't have the amendment in our packets.
It's just the committee engrossment.
Oh, I thought we already passed that.
Yes, we did.
Okay, so then we have to amend it out of the bill.
Pardon me?
Now the process is just...
Now we have to accept.
Thank you. Yep. Just a little confused there. Sorry. I had four copies of it, so I was a little...
Okay. Any discussion to the House file? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, real quickly. Has there been a fiscal note done on this bill? And if so, what was it? Or
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Albright.
Representative Scott, the review of the fiscal note is that it is silent. They do not anticipate that any costs would be affected by the Blue Ribbon Commission. It would be born out of the resources available to the Met Council.
Thank you, Mr. Shetnin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I did spend some time with Representative Albright here prior to the bill coming before the subcommittee. And the administration is officially neutral on this bill. We do have a little bit of concern regarding the makeup and diversity of the commission. And but we can continue to talk to Representative Albright about that And I can answer any questions that you may have, but I'll be back to speak to the next bill with a little bit more detail.
Perfect.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, which represents 91 member cities in the metro area before the legislature and Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities does generally support studying the Metropolitan Council to make sure that it is prepared to serve the region for the coming decades. We have had this as part of our regional governance policies for several years. I would also share some concerns with the with respect to the makeup of the group, and would want to again also assure that there is diversity on the group, and can work with Representative Albright as the bill moves forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Norman. Gentlemen, did you wish to testify? Looks like we're good. Any other member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Scott asked about cost of this. Looking on page 3, there's compensation expenses and then appropriation. So where are we sending this again?
State government finance.
State government finance. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I wanted to ask. I was confused with the answer that there's no cost, that it's going to be borne someplace else, and that's not the way I read the bill. So,
correct. It'll be taken care of in state government finance.
Thank you.
Any other member questions or discussion? House File 2104. Seeing none, Representative Albright will give you the final words, and you can renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I encourage an affirmative vote on 2104.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2104 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. As amended. As the bill is moving as amended. Representative Albright, you can stay right there, and we will move on to 2467. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this bill was also heard in subcommittee, and so I believe that the same process of adopting or accepting the committee report coming out of that committee would be necessary, and I also have some additional amendments onto that bill after we accept the committee report.
Perfect. With that, Representative Albright moves the committee engrossment. Any discussion to the committee engrossment? Seeing none, all in favor of the committee engrossment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Committee engrossment is adopted. Representative Albright will make a motion that House File 2467 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And Representative Albright moves the DE3 as an author's amendment. Any discussion of the DE3 to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to you, the bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd also like to move the A2.
Representative Albright moves the A2 to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Any discussion to the A2? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this appears like we're combining the previous bill with this bill, and it's... while I supported the previous bill to have a commission to look at the makeup of the Met Council, we are now moving this into the bill to change the makeup of the Met Council. And so aren't we putting the cart before the horse of changing it, and then we're going to study how it is now and basically predetermining how we're going to the outcome of the Blue Ribbon Commission? I guess I'm confused.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the purpose of the Blue Ribbon Commission is in a broader context to undertake the process of looking at the role and responsibilities that the Met Council has to the various functions that they have over the years been tasked with. To the extent that 2467 is adopted and codified, it does not take the effect of law until after the current administration is succeeded by a new administration. And so in the interim, we would hope that the Blue Ribbon Commission would provide a report back to us with the attempt of giving us even greater clarity as to the purposes and roles that the Met Council should provide to the Seven County metro area, but along that same line also provide for a governance structure that has been in need of some reforms that in light of the outcome of the Blue Ribbon Commission might be amended, but in light of the tasking of both entities, we would look at it as a dual-track process.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But again, it looks, if we're going to set up a Blue Ribbon Commission to look at, and again, I support that, to look at how the Met Council is performing and come up with recommendations, again, putting this with the 2467, which already is determining what we're going to change the way we do the Met Council. Again, we're doing this, having a Blue Ribbon Commission look at a predetermined outcome that we've already set up what we're going to do. I think this is foolish of us to do, I guess, to have a either we do 2467 and change the way we do the Met Council, or we do the Blue Ribbon Commission and have them come back to us and say, I mean, they look like they're mutually opposed to each other. And so I guess, I realize this is the amendment going on, and this is the way the bill that the author wants and the way the author wants it, and we normally just go along with that. But again, it's confusing to me that previous bill, we set up a Blue Ribbon Commission. Now we're going to put this Blue Ribbon Commission bill into this bill, which is already determining that we're going to change the way the Met Council's done before we look at it. So Mr. Chair, I guess I'm confused, and I just think it's the wrong way about doing this. If we're going to set up a Blue Ribbon Commission, we should let them do their job and come back to us with their recommendations, and then act on them after that. And I don't see 2467 as we should be doing that, not now. We should be waiting till after the Blue Ribbon Commission comes back with their report.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any other member questions? Put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Chair and members. To the bill that is now before you as amended, 2467. Members, a bit of a narrative in terms of the process that we've undertaken in the last several years, actually, and I have just happened to be the most current person who is the point person on trying to bring some clarity for the citizens who are affected by the role and responsibilities that the Met Council provides to us on a daily basis. But the organization itself was started over 40 years ago with the responsibility of providing clarity and guidance relevant to water and wastewater. While that is a meritorious task, and they have done an outstanding job of providing that guidance to the cities and municipalities that fall within that guideline, we candidly, as a body, and I will my own opinion state, I think we've abdicated some of our own responsibilities in terms of taking those tasks set before us and adjudicating a decision about those, and laid those at the feet of the Met Council over the years. And so by virtue of their acceptance of those responsibilities, they have grown. And they have grown in ways that to the citizens that are affected by their decisions may not be the outcome that they were looking for, and overreach is in some cases been the word used. A study published by the OLA in 2011 by Mr. Nobles, I think gave great clarity to the processes of the Met Council. And in deference to Mr. Nobles and his work, I think the overarching theme of his report was that there was a great need for a governance reformation. The Met Council suffers, and you'll hear from the testimony today, I think, from a lack of trust and a lack of faith on behalf of the people that they serve. It is in some parts due to our role of not providing them with good oversight, but in some cases I think that they have extended their reach to places where it might not otherwise be necessary, and intruded upon the service rendered by county commissioners, their governance structure, as well as municipalities. And so this bill, as it is sitting before you today, really hopes to achieve a couple of very, very specific points. The first is to go about the process of providing a staggered term mechanism for those that are appointed to the Met Council. It also joins to the appointing committee a greater clarity and openness and transparency, if you will, to those that are appointed, but also to recognize that not only county commissioners but also cities and or other elected officials should have a greater voice and opportunity to speak on behalf of their constituents as they take a look at those that are considered for appointment to the Met Council. We are not in the process of dismantling the Met Council, nor are we trying to subvert the decision-making process away from the governor or his administration. What we are trying to do is provide them with some tools that bring a greater faith and trust factor back to the Met Council on behalf of the transparency and openness to the appointment process as well as to the members that are appointed to the Met Council. In addition to that, we are making some strides in terms of providing a better clarity and hopeful of providing more of a cleaner recognition of the FTA's observation of elected officials on the MPO. And with that, as well as some other notifications to the public, I think that we can provide for the citizens a better understanding of the role and responsibilities that the Met Council serves and actually, in a grander sense, provide them with the opportunity to do and continue to do the service that they have been entrusted to do and enable them to do so in a more forthright manner. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to take questions. I understand there are a number of people that would like to speak on behalf of the bill. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I am at your convenience to pull those forward.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Mr. Shetland, why don't you make your way to the table? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Why don't you go ahead and get in line so we can make sure we get through the bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Judge Shetland with the Metropolitan Council. I'm the Director of Government Affairs. And unlike the previous bill, the council and the administration oppose House File 2467. There are issues that you'll hear from me and others here that speak to the issues of having elected officials serve on the council. There are conflict of interest issues, there are incompatibility of office issues. When you have an elected official in one way or shape serving in one post and then serving in another post that interacts with those. And so for those reasons in particular, the administration opposes that. Also, we talked about this in the subcommittee as well, but there's reference to the legislative auditor's report from 2011. That auditor's report dealt specifically with transit governance. It looked only at transit governance. It did not look at the other roles of the council's broader enterprise, like our wastewater, our land use planning, our HRA, all of the other functions that the council operates were not looked at as part of that report. So we feel that talking about this in the terms of the legislative auditor's report, if you want to talk about it in terms of the transit governance, it fits, but if you look at it as the councils were laid out in statute, that does not fit here at all. And so with that, I can take any questions, but I know that you're trying to get through this agenda, but I just wanted to point out that there are major flaws as far as the conflict of interest and the incompatibility of office, and I know Ms. Nauman's going to speak to that here in a minute as well. So thank you,
Mr. Shetland. Ms. Nauman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name again is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing 91 member cities at both the Legislature and Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities does support four-year staggered terms for Metropolitan Council members because they provide more continuity of knowledge on the Metropolitan Council over time, allow for more diversity of perspectives to be heard, and help to minimize any sort of ideological shifts on the council with the changing of gubernatorial terms. Metro Cities does support changes to the nominating committee process to add local officials, to actually require that a majority of those members be local officials, which would strengthen local government input into the selection process. We also do support the transparency measures, the notification members measures that are included in the bill. I will say that Metro Cities also does recognize a role for citizen participation on the nominating committee. Metro Cities does oppose a Metropolitan Council that is comprised of local officials, whether they be county commissioners or city officials, due to the incompatibilities of these offices, particularly around having local officials serve in both a regulated and regulatory capacity, having local officials serve and vote on two separate political subdivisions, and due to the either potential for actual or perceived conflicts of interest when you have local officials representing as an elected official one city and voting on behalf of many others on the Metropolitan Council. I will also note that Metro City's policies recognize that city officials, unlike county commissioners, do not serve in a full-time capacity in their local role, and so asking city officials to serve on the Metropolitan Council has been identified at our members by our members as being very impracticable. And so this would result in a very narrow pool of candidates from which to draw for Metropolitan Council service. Mayor Jim Hovland would like to speak, and I'm going to certainly happy to answer any questions. But
welcome to the committee, sir. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with the brief testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. I think Ms. Joachim had a question.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Hovland, H-O-V-L-A-N-D. I'm the mayor of Edina, and have been on the TAB, the Transportation Advisory Board, to the Met Council for about the same amount of time I've been the mayor, about a decade. And I will tell you candidly, when I first got on the TAB, which is solely responsible for advising the Met Council on transportation-related issues, which I think is the core of the concern that some of the counties had here in bringing forth, asking Ms. Albright, Representative Albright, to bring forward this legislation, is something we can talk about. So when I first got on the Met, Transportation Advisory Board of the Met Council, I thought, well, what's this hybrid all about? Because in most metropolitan areas where you have this metropolitan planning organization that receives money from the federal government, they might have a council of governments that's composed the way that's being suggested here, a combination of local and county officials. I thought that made sense, but over time I can tell you that I've changed my mind, and here's why. So now for the last 2 years I've been the chair, and over the last decade sitting on the TAB where we're giving the Met Council advice on transportation, I see situations where it's a tremendous amount of work for number one, and I think Met Council members work 20 to 30 hours a week at their jobs. I see the county commissioners and the elected officials that serve on the TAB having difficulty even with a 4 or 5 hour stint once a month. So I think it'd be extraordinarily difficult to task a county commissioner or task a local elected official with also serving on the Met Council. Here's another thing I worry about, and people have been talking about theoretical conflicts of interest. Here's a real one. So in our district, let's say that somebody represents Bloomington, Richfield, and Edina. Edina wants to amend its comprehensive plan to allow for more density in the Southdale area and more height on buildings. We got to get that amendment to the comprehensive plan approved by the Met Council. It doesn't just get approved by staff, it gets approved by the whole Met Council. So what if a representative for Edina, Bloomington, and Richfield is from Bloomington? And he suspects that maybe there's a business moving from Bloomington to Edina that would be asking for more density, found a better place for their business, they're growing, they're expanding. We want to do it, and he votes against us. Somebody is sitting there in a district position as a local elected official trying to represent the best interests of multiple cities, plus serve their own city as a city council person. It's impossible. It can't be done. Same thing with a county commissioner. I think it just creates all kinds of, not just theoretical, but real world problems. I like the model that the Metro Cities and the Citizens League has come up with. Over the years, as I said, I've sat on the Transportation Advisory Board, I've come to the conclusion that with the change in the big job at the governor's office, they appoint these people, and there's such a steep learning curve on all of the different transportation funding mechanisms, federal, state, all the different acronyms you have to learn, that staggered terms is a really great idea, so that you have continuity of knowledge there at all times. This idea of transparency in the nominating process, just having seven local elected officials decide who should be recommended to the governor, I think that should be expanded. There was a conversation earlier about franchise fees and expanded transparency. This is a good idea here too. A simple majority of elected officials and then compose it like the TAB, where we've got a majority elected officials, and then the rest of them are citizen members. You could do the same thing on the nominating committee. It's a small first step. It's a baby step, but it's a really smart step. It's a real wise and practical step. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and try to expect local elected officials and county officials to be able to function in the Met Council environment and have it function the way it's supposed to. Finally, I will say that if you look at the statute, there's a lot more responsibility here at the Met Council than just wastewater management. They've got responsibilities, as I mentioned, with respect to transportation, with respect to in the environment, with respect to housing, and with respect to some regional economic development activities. So the job is big. And appointing people that are competent is really important. They've got a great Met Council there now. They're very active. They're very knowledgeable. It's good to interface with them. One final point. I think one of the things that the county officials worried about was that there was going to be inequity of treatment with how federal dollars were dispersed. There's $90 million a year, roughly, that comes down from the Federal Highway Trust Fund that goes through the TAB, comes to MnDOT, goes to the Met Council, comes to TAB with the recommendation of the Met Council. So we decide how that $90 million is going to be spent. We do it in a really objective way. And the last thing we look at in deciding in these different funding categories, whether it's transit, whether it's roads and bridges, whatever the modes are, how we're spending that money is an objective sort of exercise. But the last thing we do as a group is that we look at geographic balance to make sure that we've got geographic balance on the way those monies are spent so that everybody gets treated fairly. And the last time we did this, last year, for the last what we call regional solicitation, we had every single member of that TAB, 34 people, stand up and applaud when we finished that work. And I would say, don't disrupt that model, don't disrupt that hybrid, make those tweaks that are important. We'll be well served by having those staggered terms on a four-year basis. Make those other little tweaks that are being recommended by the Citizens League and also by the Metro Cities organization and the state and particularly the region. And in fact, our global economy will be well served by giving us a chance to be a better and stronger region. Thank you.
Thank you. To all the testifiers, we have about 5 minutes left and then we're going to have to recess for session. So I'd like to get the testimony in before we come back this evening in case anyone can't. So if you could just briefly state your testimony, we'd love to hear it. Otherwise, you're welcome to come back this evening. Welcome.
Sure. Thank you very much. Members of the committee, my name is Sean Kershaw. I'm the executive director of the Citizens League. From September 2015 to March this year, Citizens League convened a broad and diverse special task force to consider possible changes to the Metropolitan Council. Our work ultimately focused on the questions of governance. To be brief, most of our recommendations are fully supported within Representative Albright's bill. We think it's important for an agency tasked with long-term planning to have fixed staggered terms. We think changing the nominating process to make it more open and transparent is important. We think that changes to the nominating committee are important. The two areas where we would disagree with the proposals are that we think the nominating committee should, we think it should include sort of general citizens as well as elected officials. So our proposal increases the size from 7 to 13, adds 3 municipal officials and 3 county officials. And we disagree that there should be elected officials on the council. We think there are significant statutory barriers. We think there are significant logistical barriers. And there are sort of some principal differences to that point. Otherwise, we are in agreement, except for those 2 points, with the bill as amended.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Appreciate it. Thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you, Troy. You let me cut in line. You'll be here tonight anyway. Well, I'm Chris Gerlach. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner, and I also have been very involved in numerous Met Council reform efforts with other suburban counties, Scott, Carver, and Anoka, as well as a handful of other local city folks in crafting up some proposals to deal with the Met Council reform issues, as well as I was a member of the 19-member Citizens League Task Force. And I will tell you that I don't have time to get into it. What I would like to do is, item by item, be able to give you some arguments about why many of the points that were just brought up in previous testimony are either good and valid or maybe fall short, and I can provide you with that, but I don't have the time to do all of that. What I want to do, what I will say is that there will be a minority report on the Citizens League Task Force, so when that comes out, you'll be able to read in detail what some of the counter-arguments are and why it can work to have elected officials on the Met Council and why that is critically important. The group of counties and city folks that have been meeting for quite some time, over months, developed a set of principles, and I have copies of that if this can be left with you to read during your floor session today. I'll leave these here. And what they are is essentially six different ideas or principles that you should use as a measuring stick when doing Met Council reform. We believe that the most important and critical piece is that the governor ought not hold all the cards. Today, the governor is elected on an agenda and then can use the Met Council as a de facto state agency to implement that agenda. There is no organic grassroots representation from the region being governed. And that is very critical, and I believe it is anti-American and anti-democratic, and that that ought to be changed, and that the appointing authority needs to change so that local governments, cities and counties, can appoint at least a majority of the Met Council members from within their ranks to represent their communities, and we should not fear this. There are all sorts of reasons why the conflict of interest, the parochialism, the regulator-regulatee piece can all be managed and dealt with like we do in many other agencies and many other situations, and we can achieve the democracy and the representation and the buy-in from local governments so they aren't dictated to from a top-down system, but rather they solve problems from a bottom-up system. The bill today makes steps in that direction, and I am supportive of it. I don't think that it necessarily goes far enough because it still leaves the appointing authority in the hands of the governor. But we are making strides in the right direction. I would encourage you to pass this bill today and to continue working on improvements, and I would be happy to help along the way.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Olson, I'm sorry, we are out of time. We will take you first if you can come back this evening. Members, we're going to go into a recess of the call of the chair, which will be approximately 6 p.m. We will meet in room 5, and we will resume with House File 2467. So with that, I will lay over House File 2467, and we are in recess until the call of the chair, approximately 6 p.m. Good evening, members. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Committee back to order, and we are going to take back up Representative Albright's bill, House File 2467. The motion on that bill is that it be sent to State Government Finance as amended. I know we left off. There's some testimony left. Mr. Olson, you can come on up to the table. I don't know, Representative Albright, if you want to reset the table of where we're at with the bill. Then, Mr. Olson, welcome. You can introduce yourself and proceed with testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, as we left, when last we met, this morning, the bill as amended really is the current contemporary attempt and desire on a bipartisan basis, not only by membership of the House, but also by participation by various task forces and alliances to really enable the Met Council to do their work in a fashion that is more clearly understandable, transparent, and accountable to the people they serve. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will defer to the testifier and hear his testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm touched that so many of you came back to hear my testimony, so I'll keep it short. I'm Troy Olson, and I represent the North Metro Mayors Association, and the North Metro Mayors Association is a collaboration of 16 mayors and cities in the Northern Metro. And the North Metro Mayors Association supports staggered terms for council members, but does not have an official opinion or official position on any of the other provisions in the bill. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, any questions for the testifier? Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the public that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we move on to member questions and discussion. House File 2467. Any member discussion? Any member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Albright, and again, I'm going to reiterate what I said earlier today, that I support the previous bill you had that you've now amended into here, having the Blue Ribbon Council to look at different ways of doing it, but the combining it with all making changes to the Met Council at the same time seems to me a little bit backwards. We should wait for the Blue Ribbon Commission to come back with their recommendations before we start making changes. This may or may not be a good thing. It may or may not be the way we eventually go. But I think it's just kind of getting, you know, the cart before the horse when we're setting a Blue Ribbon Commission to look at changes in the Met Council, and then we're making changes at the same time without looking at them. And they may come back and say this was the stupidest thing we ever done. So, anyway, with that, that's my comments.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Albright, I'll just reiterate what I've said before in the past. I really am concerned about the local electeds playing a dual role in the conflict of interest it could be. I served on the Southwest Light Rail Corridor Management Committee in an advisory capacity as a city council member, and the amount of time that took up that I had to take off of work that I didn't get paid for was pretty onerous. It was worth being there, but it can be really difficult for someone. And most city council members have other jobs. A lot of them own their own businesses, and it'd be really hard for them to do double duty. And I'm still questioning why that decision was made. I guess I'm questioning even more so now that we've had quite a few bills passed through this committee in the last few weeks that have been removing local control from city councils, down from zoning to interim ordinances to putting franchise fees on. So all these things are being taken out of local control hands as if people don't trust them to make the decisions they were elected to do. But now we're trusting them to put them on a Met Council that distributes a lot of money. So I'm just kind of confused and getting whiplash a little bit. It's either you trust them or you don't trust them. So I just wanted to get that on the record, and thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I think, and first off, I thank yous to the right side of the committee chair for providing sustenance and dessert for the committee this evening. It was not my intention to, take advantage of dessert by proxy, but I will certainly use that to my best advantage. It is a bipartisan bill, by the way. I will draw the membership's attention to two pieces that were provided to you in your packets. The first is the task force membership for the Citizens League. I think it's instructive to just take a look at the roster of folks who contributed to the fruit of that labor. Clearly, most of them are recognizable in their own right, but I think collectively they did bring to bear a great deal of deliberation on the matter, and certainly not without a robust debate on specific topics, as was shared with me. So that notwithstanding, I'm sure that as Representative Joaquin and Representative Nelson have shared, this is a type of bill that is not without its concerns on both sides of the aisle. But I do believe that what we have enabled in this legislation is an opportunity to bring some contemporary structure and a greater clarity to the mission of the Met Council in a dual-track approach that not only creates an opportunity for a commission to task itself with the long-range view of what the Met Council should be tasked with in the long-range perspective, but I also see advantages in terms of how the bill is structured in the nearer term to affect changes that certainly enable the trust and the clarity of the mission provided to the people they serve. Mr. Kershaw is back at the table with me, asked if he would be able to provide a little enabling commentary to some comments that were brought up in the testimony by the committee members as well as others, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Welcome back to the committee. Mr. Kershaw, if you would, just please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, pleased to be here. My name is Sean Kershaw, and I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens League. You heard me testify a little bit earlier. If I could provide a little bit more information, because the conversation about the Blue Ribbon panel came up, I believe you should have a copy in front of you of the membership of our task force, and we thought that might be helpful to reinforce some of the things that Representative Albright said. In the six-month process that we looked at these governance questions, we had a very diverse group of people around the table, people who had diversity of experience with the Met Council, people who were there at its inception, people who had very limited experience, people from across the geographic spectrum, ideological spectrum, different sectors. In many ways, I would say, is a blue ribbon panel. It was led by co-chairs Susan Arnst and John Knapp, and they really, over the 6 months, dove into these governance questions, and I think did a fantastic job of wrestling with how do we increase accountability in terms of the work of the council, and yet how do we preserve that special role that it has in regional governance and regional setting regional priorities. The recommendations that they, as I mentioned earlier, came up with align with the parts of the bill with two exceptions, the elected officials role and the specific makeup of the nominating committee. But the aspects that relate to transparency, that relate to staggered terms, that relate to changing the beginning to look differently at the nominating committee, are in line with what's in this bill. And it was a great process. I think a great group of people who did not enter agreeing with each other. And I say this only in terms of if it helps in the conversation about what a blue ribbon panel might bring. I think those same things were brought to the conversation we had about governance and the recommendations we developed.
Thank you, Mr. Kershaw. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question for Mr. Kershaw. Could you remind me again earlier in your testimony? It feels like yesterday, practically. Did you say that you were your group was opposed to current elected officials serving on the board?
That was one of the differences, yes, Chair, Representative. That was one of the differences mm-hmm. with the bill right now. There were several reasons that they disagreed with that. One is the statutory questions. Second is there's a number of logistical concerns about serving those roles in terms of time. And I think there were fundamentally some principle differences, saying that it was important for members of the council to have, you know, sort of a different perspective. Not that one is bad, but that there were principle differences as well as statutory and logistical differences.
Representative Joaquim, a follow-up? That's good. Members, any other questions? Anyone else that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Albright will give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, I have a piece of pie with ice cream in front of me, and so I will defer to the chair, but thank the committee for their consideration of this bill going forward.
Thank you. With that, members, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2467 be referred to State Government Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, members. With that, we'll do House File 2771, Representative Bly.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Bly. And so I will move your House File 2771, and I understand that it is going to the General Register. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I also see that we have a number of amendments.
They're not my amendments, so I'm not sure exactly how you want to deal with that.
Okay. I'll have you introduce your bill,
okay.
Please.
Thank you, Chair. So the purpose of my bill came to me from constituents who are concerned about what's happening to agriculture and would like to have an opportunity, on the one hand, to consider moving into organic
agriculture as opposed to conventional agriculture. And also, I do have a number of organic farmers in my district, and they're interested in trying to attract processors that might be centralized in their area. And I had introduced a bill that would create a agricultural zone, which would, it's kind of like a pilot, I suppose you could say, in a sense. And within that zone, there would be certain incentives applied. I haven't defined what those would be, but that's something that someone could work out. And the idea would be that it would incentivize farmers who wanted to switch to organic from conventional agriculture. They would get some supports in doing that and be able to do it in a reasonable way. Farmers, I'm hearing farmers, actually recently I attended the Department of Education Organic Conference. There were a number of farmers there who were conventional farmers, and with the drop in grain prices and with the cost of inputs, they're looking at the possibility of moving to organic agriculture and see it as something that may be more profitable for them or may make it easier for them to make it as farmers. So that's sort of what led to the thinking of this bill. And what I'm trying to do is, what the idea that I had was I wanted to consult with or at least put in front of the Organic Task Force, which gives information to the Department of Agriculture, what are some things, some incentives that might work that they would recommend to the Department of Agriculture. And when I looked at the Organic Task Force, we hear from them every 5 years. And that seems like quite a distant time before we would get some recommendations for how we might help farmers who want to make that transition. And I also noticed that in a year, or at the end of the year, the task force will be sunsetted. So the purpose of my bill is to extend the task force for a couple of years and ask for a report from the task force to let the legislature know what kind of legislation we might be able to help those farmers who want to transition from conventional agricultural to organic. Now, I have had some questions in that part of the report because people look at organic zones and they think, oh dear, he's going to say you can't do anything but organic farming in those zones. That's not true. All I want to do is, as I described before, be able to suggest that we might have an area where organic processing might be attracted and centralized, and those farmers could benefit from not having to truck their produce or their products so far to get that processing. So the purpose of my bill is primarily as I want to get some feedback from the task force back to the legislature in a timely manner so that we as legislators might be able to help out those farmers who want to transition from conventional to organics. The only change I make in the task force is the date when it sunsets, and so, you know, I know one of the amendments has to do with the composition of the task force. I'm neutral on that. We can talk about that. The other bill would remove the report, which is the whole purpose of my bill. So the amendment that let me see which number it is. Amendment A, the A1 amendment makes my my bill without a purpose.
And members, does anyone have any questions or Representative Scott?
Madam Chair, just whenever you're ready, I'd like to move the amendments.
And Representative Scott, would you like to move the A1?
Sure, I'd like to move the A1.
Okay, Representative Scott has moved the A1, so we'll have a discussion.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that the markets need to determine all this. I don't think we need this task force. I don't think we need the report. I think the markets need to determine the viability of organic farming. So that's why I have the amendment.
Could I comment?
Represented by?
Yes. Well, we certainly incentivize and subsidize all kinds of agriculture. We wouldn't have an ethanol program had we not subsidized it. We create markets. organic farming, and the reason that farmers are being attracted from conventional to organic is that they see it as a way that they can survive in agriculture. And all I'm asking for is information about how to, it's a difficult process to transition from conventional to get the certification to be organic. You have to have your land sit unused for a period of time, 3 years, I believe, in order to get that certification. So to go without any income during that time would be difficult, would be a challenge. And so I think if there are farmers who wish to make that change, I don't see any reason why we should continue to make it more difficult for them to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
I don't think having this report is going to make any difference in that.
Okay, well, the report I'm requesting, Chair, the report I'm requesting, may decide that, and that's true. May decide there's nothing we can do to help people who want to make that change. But we might also discover that there are things that the task force could recommend. I don't see anything wrong with engaging them and asking them to give us some suggestions and advice.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw this amendment, but I do want to offer the A2.
Okay. Representative Ewing.
Thank you, Chair. My question was somewhat to the A1, but maybe more just informational from Representative Bly. Could you describe maybe some, you just mentioned that some smaller farmers to make it might move over to organic. Could you maybe give some examples of who's starting to look at those programs? I'm not as familiar with the agricultural industry.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Representative Bly.
Chair Representative. As I mentioned earlier, attending the organic conference at the Department of Agriculture, I was surprised to see a number of conventional farmers who were there checking out to see, I mean, they have experienced increases in prices in the inputs, the fertilizer, the pesticides, the herbicides that they use. There are some very interesting things happening in the world of organics with other non-chemical ways of controlling pests and getting the plants to have the increased yields that you might get from chemical fertilizer. I think also you would see improvements. I mean, there's a lot of talk about water quality. Moving to organics, you know, aside from that, a side effect of that is to see improvements in water quality because you're not applying the chemicals that you would in other ways. So I think those are all reasons that farmers might consider moving from traditional agriculture. I'm not saying that there are all kinds of them, but when the price of corn is dropped to $3 or $4 a bushel and they're looking at organic farmers getting $7 to $12 a bushel for their corn, becomes attractive. And right now we are importing corn from Romania, organic corn from Romania, because we can't get enough of it. The demand is increasing. And this is true of organic milk, for instance. The conventional milk is low price. A lot of dairy farmers are thinking of going out of business. And if they went organic, there is an affordable price that they can get for the organic milk. There's greater increasing demand for organics. And I think it makes sense to respond to that message that the market is giving to farmers. And they're trying to make that, they're trying to respond to the interest that the market is, message the market is giving them. Prices are going up in organics, they're dropping in conventional, and besides you can avoid the cost of the inputs that you'd have to put in. I think it makes sense that there would be some farmers who would look at that. I also think that because of the price that beginning farmers might be able to get from organics might make it more profitable for them in the beginning to start out that way.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the latitude. It's very, very fascinating, and it almost makes it sound like really we're helping out a lot, some of our small farmers and farmers thinking about transitioning, trying to help. We keep hearing in property taxes and local government the burdens that they're facing right now and agricultural lands, and the price is going down, the commodity is going down. So I think anything we can do to help them out would be great, and I think this is a good start. Thank you.
Representative Scott withdrew her A1. Representative Scott, would you like to introduce the A2?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment addresses the need to consider that we can't feed the world by putting more and more acres are taking more and more acres out of production with conventional farming and putting in organic. And it's not the best way to serve the poor of our country or the poor of our nation. Organic food is expensive, and it takes more acres to grow organic than it does to feed the same amount of people with conventional practices. So I just wanted that to be a consideration from the, I guess it's the commissioner. That should be something that they should take a look at when they're putting together what the best formula is for, you know, what you're trying to do here, Representative Bly, with for organic production and this task force. And I thought it would be good to add some different perspectives onto the task force from the private sector. I thought, so I put here that there should be one member of the Farm Bureau and one member of appointed from the Minnesota Farmers Union, and then that just some of the folks that, rather than having a commissioner appoint several of these folks, that they would be appointed by the industries that they represent. So the grocers would, appoint their own person. And as you can read through the rest of the amendment, other folks too. Then I added the Agri-Growth Council because I feel like that's a really comprehensive ag-related trade organization that I think would be beneficial to have their input. Ask for your support.
Representative Bly?
Thank you, Chair. I don't really have any negative feelings about these recommendations. A lot of the studies are showing that there isn't really that much difference in the yield of organic and conventional agriculture. And I don't see any harm in having that conversation. There already is a Farm Bureau member on the board, and Farmers Union members have been on the board or the task force in the past. It might be really helpful to have a grocer who retails organic food in the. So I don't see a problem with that. I'm not really sure what agri-growth would add. You know, they may get bored being on the task force. I don't know. But I don't have any aversion to it. It's not a terrible thing. So I would think that the amendment is fine if you want to add it on.
Thank you, Representative Bly. Representative Joaquin?
Thank you, Chair. I do have one little concern about the amendment. From the way I'm reading it and annotating it, it looks like it's taking away the one organic consumer representative, so someone who's actually a consumer would be taken off the board.
That wasn't my intent.
That was my intent. I think on 1.8 to the amendment, it says strike everything after 10, and that would mean 11's dropped off, right? Or no? Am I reading it wrong, Council?
Mr.
I'm
Shepherd.
Reading it wrong, aren't I? Is it late at night?
Oh. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, and I yield to Representative Scott's intent, but I do think it's not the way you're reading it.
Good.
It appears on page, on line 8 of the amendment, it's striking the retailer of organic products and inserting the retailer of organic products that would be appointed by the Grocers Association. And then on page the member appointed by the Agri-Growth Council is an additional member. I don't think it's striking the consumer representative.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for clearing that up. And I had one more question for Representative Bly. When I asked you about organic farming, you mentioned that we're importing organic corn from what country?
Romania.
Right now? So the world's actually feeding us. We're not feeding the world, so I just want to clear that up.
No, the world's not. The world, no.
You got that wrong. That.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's a false statement, a misleading statement, because...
Excuse me?
That's organic corn that we're bringing in.
Members, are there any other questions or any other comments about the specific to the amendment? Hearing none, then Representative Scott renews her motion to adopt the A2. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Okay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Okay, and so Representative Bly, to your bill as amended.
I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to present my bill to your committee, and I hope that you... We consider helping out those farmers who want to make that transition by giving the legislature some advice about how we might aid them in doing that best.
And members, is there any discussion on the bill? Are there any members of the public that would like to weigh in? Okay, thank you. Well, then, Representative Bly, I renew the motion to send your bill to the General Register. All members...
As amended.
Thank you. All members in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill moves to the General Register.
Thank you very much.
Representative Sanders. Hey, Chair Sanders, would you like to move your House File 3554?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll move House File 3554 to put in front of the committee this evening. And this bill is a very technical bill, but a very important bill. And we still have a lot of discussion going on right now with a lot of the stakeholders. So tonight I want to have a good in-depth discussion and lay the bill over and come back tomorrow and hopefully take up a solution to this bill, because I think it's that important. So if members will bear with me, I think this discussion is important and worth having, but also I don't think we're at a point where we can vote on the bill. So I'll move that we lay the bill over at the end of our discussion. And I think it's what we're dealing with in this bill is a scenario that's popping up, and I've noticed is in authoring other telecom legislation that we are approximately 20 years out of date with most of our telecom regulations, and technology is changing so rapidly and so quickly in this country and around the world. If you think about the fact that the iPad was introduced in 2007, how much the deployment, how rapid technology has gripped our lives and how much we use it. And the deployment mechanisms of that, and if you think about, we started off with 3G and 4G, and you know, we're at capacity right now, we're very close to it right now in the state, and the next best thing will be 5G that comes out, and we need a way to deploy that across the state of Minnesota. And it sets up an interesting discussion and some very big challenges in that relationship between government and business and the consumers. And so that's the discussion I'd like to have. I have several testifiers with me tonight. We certainly want to hear from the cities and get their specifics and their concerns on the record as well, and hopefully arrive at a solution that works for the state of Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, if it's all right, I'd like to introduce a couple testifiers and have them go through some testimony.
Absolutely, Chair Sanders. Would you please state your name for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
My name is Courtney Bednarz with Verizon Wireless. Good evening, Chairman, Representatives. Thank you for giving me the opportunity this evening to address an issue that's very important to my company. I should mention, by way of background, I am a former city planner for the city of Andover for 11 years, and I'm now employed, obviously, with Verizon Wireless. So I have seen zoning development
Representative
approval
Scott,
issues
excuse
from
me.
Both sides.
Not to interrupt, but just yay Andover. Thank you.
Oh. Thank you. Go ahead.
Testifier.
Simply put, my job with Verizon is to find the best locations to install our equipment to address what is increasingly becoming an overloaded network situation. We have a critical problem. Our 4G LTE network is at critical mass and at risk of capacity overload in cities across the state. Perhaps you've tried downloading a document or downloading a video and have been subject to that spinning wheel or a drop call or a total loss of connection. Without the ability to increase wireless broadband data capacity, these experiences across the state are only going to get worse. There's an explosion in online video streaming sites like Netflix, YouTube, Apple TV, and others, coupled with uploading video to Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and other social media sites.
wireless broadband usage by our customers and your constituents has hit record levels and is going to increase exponentially in the coming years. In fact, some analysts project wireless broadband data usage will increase over 650% by 2018. You don't have to look much further than this week's NCAA basketball tournament for an example. Recent surveys suggest that one-third of all viewers and 58% of millennials will watch one of the games on a tablet or other device during the tournament's run. While we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in Minnesota since 2000 and billions more across the country to build the most reliable wireless network, our network is being pushed to the brink. If you think of like a tall glass of water, which represents a macro cell tower, as people use their phones, tablets, and devices throughout the day, they draw that water or capacity down, especially during peak periods. At some point, there's no more water, there's no more capacity, and that results in unreliable service, dropped calls, and a general negative user experience. That's the network as we're experiencing it today at peak periods. It doesn't have to be this way. A solution called small cell technology can provide the much-needed capacity to address current needs in our communities. Unlike the traditional cell tower sites, small cell technology can be easily attached at existing utility and light pole locations that have already went through the local siting process. Small cells generally consist of two radios approximately the size of a briefcase and one or two antennas approximately 2 feet by 2 feet in size. This low-impact design minimizes aesthetic impacts and quickly blends in with the surrounding neighborhood. This is the type of technology we wish we had over the past 10 years when we were talking about these traditional 150, 200 cell tower sites. Small cells are strategically located in areas of high wireless demand, like urban centers, college campuses, and sports stadiums. These locations offload the existing macro tower sites by providing network capacity where it's needed most. And as a result, they free up network capacity across the entire network, creating a greater user experience. This process is not limited to our current 4G LTE network. As mentioned, in the next approximately 18 months, Verizon will be rolling out 5G, the most advanced wireless network ever, that will be 100 times faster than the current 4G LTE network. Now that sounds exciting, it sounds straightforward, it sounds like a very positive thing, and we believe that it is. And without a doubt, elected and appointed officials throughout the state are becoming more and more aware of the growing customer demand for mobile broadband. Many of these leaders have young children or teenagers who use it as much as anyone. And to be fair, many cities and towns have been terrific partners in the deployment of our small cell network. However, other cities have been putting up impediments to siting small cells. We have experienced delays in processing permits up to 6 months and in some cases greater than a year. We have heard cities say that they have an existing tower ordinance and treat our applications in the same way they would treat a 150-foot cell phone tower, with the same application requirements, the same legislative approval process, using ordinances that were adopted in some cases more than a decade ago. Some communities identify that their existing tower code does not apply well to our small cells, and they don't know how to process the application, and that leads to delays. Some communities reject the idea out of hand, or simply do not respond to repeated inquiries or attempts to explain the new technology. Some communities that are willing to allow small cells view small cells not as an enhancement to the community, not under the cost of maintaining the public right-of-way, but as an opportunity to enhance revenue and attempting to levy as much as 100 times what the FCC deems as an acceptable rate. Saying yes to a permit application is an answer. Saying no to a permit application is an answer. Inaction is not an answer, nor is requiring a public hearing or securing a special use permit
We're paying exorbitant fees to third-party consultants, which offer nothing more than a roadmap to delay, do not benefit the communities, the end user, or contribute to a fair and consistent approval process. The FCC, in an order initiated in 2014, felt so strongly that small cell siting should be streamlined that they established a full attachment rate that investor-owned utilities can charge wireless providers. That rate is approximately $150 per pole per year. With 853 cities, towns, communities across Minnesota, wireless carriers must navigate different processes that are inconsistent from community to community. These efforts are time-consuming, expensive, and inefficient for both the communities and the wireless carrier. And finally, if I may, I'd like to address some portions of the bill that may be misunderstood. The bill establishes a streamlined approach for all wireless providers and municipalities to follow while continuing to maintain local oversight while establishing a reasonable and specified time frame. The bill does not remove local oversight over the permitting process. The municipality has the right to deny an application. The wireless carrier has an opportunity to correct that deficiency should that application be denied. The bill does not eliminate municipal requirements for building electrical or right-of-way permits. The bill does not prevent a municipality from entering into a contract of small cell facilities with the wireless carrier. The bill does not allow wireless carriers to place this technology in communities without their input. In conclusion, to ensure Minnesota's mobile broadband future remains bright, I ask that you consider supporting the Minnesota Small Wireless Facilities Deployment Act. This important bill strikes a balance in encouraging ongoing investment in mobile broadband data technologies that consumers, businesses, and government increasingly demand. It maintains the local government's oversight of the public infrastructure and right-of-way. Thank you, Chair and Representative.
Thank you. Thank you to the testifier. And Chair Sanders, is there another testifier?
Madam Chair, at this time we are happy to stand for questions or move on to other. I know there are other folks in the room that would like to testify as well.
Well, members, does anyone have a question now? Otherwise, we will move to any other testifiers. Okay. Seeing none, if there are any other members of the public that would like to speak, if you could come forward. Welcome to the committee. You would please introduce yourself for the record. You would please introduce yourself for the record. That would be great, and then you can get on with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. I think I've been here a few times in the last week or two opposing legislation. I hate to get that reputation in front of this committee, but once again, the League of Cities feels actually very strongly against this particular piece of legislation. I do want to thank Representative Sanders, though, for hearing our concerns yesterday and today, and I think we're making some progress in the discussions, if I'm not mistaken. I heard the comment just now that Verizon thinks this bill does a good balance in terms of weighing the needs of the wireless community versus that of communities. I would say it doesn't even come close, as it's currently written, to a striking a balance. Our cities probably have as much interest in making sure that there's adequate wireless deployment in their communities. We depend on that as much as our citizens do. So we're certainly not unsympathetic to that point of view. The problem with this bill, though, as drafted, is it does six or seven different things that I think are just unprecedented in terms of taking away municipal authority. It basically strips municipal authority to do anything in terms of relocate co-location requirements, regulating co-location requirements. It preempts almost totally city zoning authority over these kind of activities. It takes away completely, in my estimation, the city's ability to kind of negotiate terms, conditions, when and where and how leases are entered into for public property. For instance, the bill even goes so far as saying that while these negotiations are ongoing, the wireless facility has the right to go on city water towers, city poles, even while their negotiations are ongoing. It basically says cities have very little, if any, kind of authority to determine the terms and conditions of those leases that exist. Just yesterday, we really found out about this bill, and one of the examples that came to light for us was a situation down in Rochester where Verizon was negotiating with the city of Rochester to have these small cell units put on their light poles. After the city and Verizon entered into negotiations, the city of Rochester decided not to allow Verizon to put their small cell units on the light poles for several reasons. Number one, they were concerned about the structural integrity of the poles. They were concerned about whether these Verizon units would affect the main purpose for the light poles. And they were concerned about if we let Verizon on our pole, do we have to let the next four or five cellular companies put these facilities on our poles, which just amplified even further their concerns about the structural integrity. And they were very concerned. They're very interested in obviously providing wireless service, wireless broadband service in the Mayo area. But they didn't want to give up their regulatory and zoning authority and their authority to decide what is proper and best use of the public right-of-way at the expense of these facilities, so they turned them down. This bill really seeks to strip the authority of local governments to make decisions for what they think is best. Again, weighing the public right-of-way versus the need for wireless service. Again, we've had some discussions with Representative Sanders. We're hoping that further discussions will be ongoing, but right now we feel very, very strongly against this bill for all the reasons we've articulated.
Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer, for your testimony. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Sanders. Mr. Grundhofer, hearkening back to my days as a mayor, the city of Waconia rented the light pole standards from Xcel, and I know a lot of other small cities do. How would this affect that relationship? Because if the underlying owner doesn't consent to the deployment, how does that affect the city?
Representative Chair Sanders?
Bring up the technological experts.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Littlejohn. With respect to specifically investor-owned poles, the FCC has already imposed a set of rules on NSP and the other providers that require them to allow those attachments. So the FCC has already seen that doesn't apply to cities, but with respect to all investor-owned utilities, that would be Xcel Energy, that would be the telephone companies if they have telephone poles. There's already a set rule that requires that attachment be allowed, and that's because the FCC realized that the only way to get this technology out into the community is to require the people that have existing structures there already allow these very small units to go on there.
Representative,
so the NSP couldn't withhold its consent.
I see we have another testifier. Sir, would you please take to the stand and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Black. I'm with Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association.
And I just recently heard about the legislation, I think Thursday, Friday last week, and immediately started hearing some concern from our membership. And I just wanted to get involved in the conversation. And I think that from what I'm hearing, well, there are 125 municipal electric utilities in Minnesota. About half of those maintain street lights that are owned by the city. Now, this legislation doesn't apply to utility-owned street lights, but I think that there it would benefit from some utility perspective on technical issues that arise when you know, service providers approach municipal utility towns, and the municipal utility gets involved in understanding the issues that the city and the public works may not understand. And we would love to have some more input and analysis of, you know, what is going on with the streetlight pole, the load that it carries, what it's intended to carry. You know, these issues I don't think are explained through. They may be understood by people bringing, supporting the legislation, but I think that the committee, I think that the legislature would benefit from a further analysis of, you know, what are streetlights designed to do, and what are they able to do, and more importantly, who determines what those things are? Is that covered in this legislation? It says that the municipality may deny an application based on the authority's regulations. Well, a lot of them don't have regulations in place to deal with this, and so I think it might help to get a broader understanding. And I think that if this bill affected utilities, there might be, I don't know for sure, I don't speak for the other utilities, but I think that they might have a lot to say about this. And I don't know fully what the FCC or the federal government requires of them, but I think that they're absent from this, and I just want to make sure that you get some input from, and I can try to help provide that from some of the municipal utilities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Black, for joining the conversation. Do any of the testifiers want to say something else? I see some moving closer to the microphones. Yes.
If I could.
Absolutely.
Representatives, to address a couple of items that were raised, first on some of the technical details like the structural capacity of a light pole. In relationships with utility companies, Verizon at least partners with the utility company to have them run the structural, and then we would pay for any replacement pole costs or any upgrades that were necessary. Or alternatively, Verizon itself would run that structural report and, again, replace the pole or provide any upgrades, make ready at its expense, as well as electrical and fiber, and anything necessary for the installation would be at Verizon's cost. Since the Rochester example was raised, I feel I do need to add a little bit of color to that situation. Basically, the downtown Rochester poles are owned by or operated by Rochester Public Utilities, an arm of the city government. And basically, based on a memorandum to their council, suddenly when we had thought we had negotiated at least a conversation with Rochester, they denied our application suddenly at an evening meeting without disclosing that in a last-minute change of heart to us. And we were not allowed the opportunity to respond or try to address any of their concerns. So that adds to perhaps my earlier statements about the difficulty in trying to build a consistent and open process. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, are there any questions? Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. First, I want to thank you, Representative Sanders, for listening to the League and working with the folks. It really is greatly, greatly appreciated. And thank you to the visuals. I'm a very visual person. I was asking my math teacher husband last night about what 6 cubic feet would look like. And his first question was, well, is there any parameters on how many feet long or wide it can be? So there was a question there. You might say 6 cubic feet, but it could be 2 yards long and 1 inch wide, or, you know, so trying to maybe understand the parameters on that. Could you tell me where the pictures are from?
I'm trying to figure out.
Well, those pictures are from Chicago, correct, Mike?
Oh. I think I recognize
I'm not sure
one.
Which set you have.
Rice Park.
Actually one's near the Landmark Center. I'm Michael McDermott from Verizon, I'm sorry. The other one is downtown St. Paul near the CenturyLink building near Kellogg. And the first one is the City of Chicago Police Department. I added that because it had the macro tower in the back. I wanted to show the sort of macro towers being yesterday, the small cells being technology of today in the future. And the 5G technology that we're talking about is actually going to be smaller than a bread box. Some of our consultants are suggesting that it could be the size of a brick. But because the radio frequency spectrum is going to be higher, we're going to have more of them. And about every 200 yards, approximately. But the size of a brick is not going to be anything anyone would notice. Most people will drive by these small cells today and see that they're not that intrusive. I do have a diagram, if the chair would allow, that I can distribute to the committee that will show you exactly what 28 cubic feet would look like on the pole, and that would be the black box. The red box is actually 28. So our equipment's smaller than what's allowable under the proposed act. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. McDermott. Representative Joaquin.
Yes, further question then. Since you do have them in St. Paul, could you tell me a little bit about the process you went through with St. Paul to get your light poles on? Our light poles. Get your products on the light poles.
Mr. Little.
I'm not standing when the music stops.
Mr. Littlejohn.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Yes, in St. Paul, we broached the subject with the City of St. Paul. There's a gentleman who is a consultant for Verizon Wireless who used to work in the utility business, and he understands the structures and loading and that sort of thing, and broached the subject with the staff, who said, yes, we need better service. In fact, there are some fire stations in St. Paul that need better data service, and we'd like to install these outside those facilities, too. Broached the subject with them. Liked the idea, looked at the code, saw that we needed to have either an agreement or a permitting process, and sort of went together up the learning curve. Minneapolis and St. Paul both have taken different approaches, but have come up with a very reasonable approach, and it would be consistent with the provisions of this statute. The problem is that with 835 cities in Minnesota, let's call it 150 that would probably have small cells because of the need for, you know, places where there are, where tourism congregates, where there's a lot of tourists in one place, as well as the, you know, the malls and the downtown areas and the local shopping areas. There just isn't time to take all of those cities up that same learning curve that took, you know, 15 to 17 months in St. Paul when you're talking about such small equipment. And so we're looking to the legislature for help with that so that we can bring the service to the constituents that they want. Because there just isn't that kind of time.
And follow up, Representative Ewing.
Yes, Chair, you kind of answered a few of my questions, my concerns yourself. You talk about a learning curve, and you, St. Paul and Minneapolis have proven that you don't have to take away local control to get what you need. And I do worry about smaller towns and the learning curve and the staffing that it takes to understand. So I get that. But I hate to take away their local control just so that things can move faster. And I noticed on 4.31 to 4.35, I need a little help from council because I didn't get the sections of the statute law that are mentioned in 4.31. When it says notwithstanding sections, what are those sections referring to?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Joaquin, the statute, the 394 is the county planning statute, and 462 is the municipal planning statute that affects cities and towns. The reference there is to the interim ordinances that we heard about the other day, moratoriums. So it's said the section, that paragraph is relating to no moratoriums.
Representative Joaquin.
So, Ms. Dyson, so is it saying that you can disregard the interim ordinances and moratoriums, or that you have to go through that process first.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Joachim, it's saying that an authority, which is defined earlier, local government, must not institute a moratorium on filing, receiving, or processing. So it's basically disallowing moratorium ordinances. But I believe the League would like to speak to this also.
Yes, to the fist fire.
Madam Chair, members, just as an example, City of Elk River, just in the last month or two, had an application to have, I don't know if it came from Verizon or another community or another provider, to put 170 poles up in their community, up in the right-of-ways. And what the city did, because they weren't prepared for it, to deal with the regulatory issues associated with that, they put a moratorium in place for a limited period of time so they could study that. The way that provision that you mentioned is dealt with, it would preclude local governments from doing that to a study period to figure out how to deal with it.
Thank you, Mr. Grunhofer. Representative Joachim.
Madam Chair, just so I understand, did you say they wanted to add in 170 poles in town?
The provider wanted to add 170 poles or whatever to put the facilities on for this kind of thing. At least that's what we understand.
Got it. And Madam Chair.
Mr. Littlejohn.
That's not our client. That's not Verizon Wireless. I'm surprised at that request, but I guess it's possible. 170 poles sounds like an awful lot since we have rolled out something like 19 in downtown St. Paul. I can't imagine 170 poles in Elk River.
A lot of technology being used there.
Probably there'll be that many at some point in Minneapolis in anticipation of the Super Bowl, for instance, where you know you're going to have throngs of people that are all going to be on their device. But that's an incredible number.
Representative Joachim.
Madam Chair, thank you. I believe you just hit another crux of the problem, is that while Verizon may be very good actors and working with St. Paul and working with Minneapolis, there are other actors in the game too, and cities need to be able to control the right-of-way that they have and protect the public good. I'm just really concerned about taking that ability away, especially smaller towns that need some time to figure things out and figure out how to make that balance between the public good and businesses, because that happens all the time. I had a technical question maybe you can help me with, just because I'm trying to understand. Do you draw power off the light pole then, too, when you place the stuff on there?
It depends.
Madam Mr. Chair, Littlejohn.
Pardon me, Madam Chair, Representative. As you can tell, I'm not familiar with the forum. Pardon me. If the city agrees to allow power use, then Verizon Wireless will do that and will pay an additional fee for the power. But that's not for co-location, and it's also not for the use of the right-of-way. There's already a statute in Minnesota and a series of rules that have been adopted with respect to charging for the use of the rights-of-way and cities recovering their cost, and none of that is changed by this. In fact, there's a section in the statute that specifically preserves the rights of cities to charge for the rights of way to recover the cost. The legislature already went down that road years ago in Chapter 237, 163, and that's preserved in this. If I may, the question of cities taking their time, it's sort of they probably want to take time, but they would do so at the expense of their constituents. And you're talking about such a small facility that it seems something that the legislature could step in and say, you know, you don't need to spend that kind of time for these kind of facilities. This isn't a 250-foot tower with an equipment building that, you know, the size of the space between these chairs. This is a briefcase and a couple small antennas, and it's detrimental to the citizens of the state to delay it.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Littlejohn, it may seem small to you, but you probably haven't sat in a city council meeting when people are arguing over connecting 2 feet of sidewalk either. So when it comes to right-of-way, it's not always small. I think I'll reserve the rest of my questions. I'm getting a better grasp on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Sanders.
Madam Chair and Representative Joachim, kind of to that point, I mean, for me, that's the point of all of this. And I've spent just a little bit of time in the legislature and telecom. I'm telling you, we are so far behind in this state from many other states and the rest of the world when it comes to technology. Literally, our statutes have not been updated in 20 years. Think about the technological advances that have happened, rapid deployment of the internet, wireless. The problem that we run into is, and the problem that I'd like to discuss, is how much time is enough time? That's really what we need to discuss. It's what we need to answer. That's part of the discussion we need to have, is how much time is enough time? I mean, if it's a year in a city like Elk River, well, they don't have 5G, but Minneapolis does. I mean, that, you know, so at some point, maybe there should be a template. There should be some sort of uniformity to say, you know, X amount of days is enough time to decide whether or not this works. I mean, that's kind of the discussion that I think we need to have. And the reason why I'm so excited about this is just the advances that we have in technology. But again, just from some of the other bills that I've had and some of the other big pieces of technology reform that are moving are still 10 years behind where we should actually be. So, you know, I don't disagree with your point, and I respect where you're coming from your time in a city council. But the one of the big questions we need to answer is how much time? And then, is there a learning curve? Yes. Do the carriers have the ability to come back and explain, like we're doing tonight, well, it depends if we're going to use your power or not, right? Versus saying, like, well, we just don't even know, so no. And I just fear that that's the issue we run into across the state. When we don't understand technology, it's easier as a state to say no, or easy as government just to say no, than it is to move things forward. So that's kind of where the genesis of where I'm coming from on all of this. This language is not perfect. This language, as written, is not moving forward completely as drafted. But those are some of the things that we need to address, because I don't want Minnesota to be left behind. And if we're talking about deploying broadband and broadband funding for rural Minnesota, but we don't have small cell technology moving along with it, we don't have some of the other bills that we're talking about in telecom reform, I mean, it almost means nothing. I mean, the money's not going to do anything because we're not going to be able to deploy the technology the way that we need to. So very big problems, and hopefully we can work towards a solution. But that's where I'm coming from. I don't want to completely strip away everyone's power, but there's got to be a mechanism to say, here's the window of time you have to decide. There needs to be able to be for the carriers to come back and say, hey, we can answer and alleviate your questions or concerns. And at that point, a city can, you know, make an answer and be held accountable to their constituents one way or the other. But for me, I think that's kind of the direction we need to go to, and I'm happy to look at language that moves us in that direction.
And Representative Joaquin has one more question.
Yes, I do. Madam
Short
Chair,
question.
Thank you. No, I want to thank you, Representative Sanders, for being willing to work on this. I just, you know, maybe instead of stripping out the moratorium language, you can look at a certain time limit a city has to decide instead. I'm sure the League and AMC will have some input on that. One question. Is there anywhere that, and this is for Mr. LeJohn maybe, has Verizon approached public businesses to put their boxes on or their towers on? Because I'm sure a business that would like a little income might jump at that chance. So why go the public route when you could go a private route?
Mr. Littlejohn.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, in fact, these facilities do go on. You know, where there's a spot available, it goes. They can be put on, you know, in parking lots, on light poles that exist. In fact, that's pretty common. Although, I have to tell you, we even run into questions of zoning when there's an existing structure there. I mean, all of these that we're talking about, this is not putting 170 poles down the highway. This is, you know, putting something on an existing structure. The city's already looked at it. They know that structure's there. They know that it's in the right spot for that structure. You're just adding a little thing to it. In many cities, we go through zoning, and that's why the bill includes language that creates this as a designates this as a permitted use. As long as it's small, you know, we're not talking about macro cells, we're not talking about the large cells, but if it's small, The bill provides that it has to be treated as a permitted use throughout the city, so that you don't have to spend time in zoning getting a conditional use permit for something exceedingly small.
Thank you, Chair. And for your indulgence, I am baking tonight and bringing cookies tomorrow. So thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Joaquim. Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, I have some questions that I'll ask offline in the interest of time, but I would like to see the improved language, because as much as I am, rumor has it, I like technology as well, but I also have questions as regards to the city's abilities to make some decisions. So I appreciate Chair Sanders. I know he'll work with me on this, but so a lot of questions still.
And Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, just real quick and I just want very quickly from the panel that's assembled. We are, as Chairman Sanders had pointed out, dealing with broadband issues as well. Does your technology allow for communities that don't have broadband to be able to get internet and reliable internet access that could help Minnesota solve some of its interim problems with access?
Chair, Representative, yes, absolutely. Certainly with small cell technology, we wanted to address the biggest concerns first in metropolitan areas like downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul. But we're already rolling out into the suburbs in northern Minnesota and more distant places with the small cell technology. So it's not just an urban answer. It's a way to address a need specific in a small town area where a small cell can cover that smaller area. Without the huge, 200-foot tower that wouldn't be necessary or economically feasible.
Mr. Littlejohn, or does anyone else have anything to add to that? Oh, no. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question that just come to my mind when you mentioned small towns in northern Minnesota, number one, I got a spot for you that, but anyway. It would help my cabin, but anyway, that's a whole other. Are these connected to wires? Then the bits up there, are they hardwired into a system, or are they all strictly wireless to wireless? How does that work? Because if you put these things up someplace remote, that you're a remote town, that eventually they got to come back to some hardwired facility, I believe.
Correct.
Yes.
Chair Representative, there's two really components here: electrical and fiber optic connection. Now, typically we like to work with a local fiber provider to provide the connection from the small cell installation through their fiber network back to a macro site where the baseband equipment is. If that's not possible, there's a microwave solution where you have a donor and a receiver, but typically it's going to be electrical and fiber and utilizing that local fiber network.
Representative Nelson?
Okay.
Members, does anyone have any other questions? Any other members of the public? No. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Sanders, I'm just wondering, if we put one here, would we have better service?
Chair Sanders.
There's a whole lot to that story, Madam Chair.
Demonstration.
Okay.
Yes, I for better service in the state office building.
Okay, so members, it sounds like we've just started this conversation, and we're going to be laying this bill over for future consideration. And with that, Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Joaquim, you indicated earlier that you were going to be doing some baking tonight. Are you taking requests, or how is that working?
Well, you see, last night I got home late, so I already made up the dough that's sitting in the freezer for freezer box cookies, another old-fashioned recipe. So I will be going home to slice them and bake them.
We have more weeks to come, so we'll get back to you.
Yes, just let me know.
Weight gain here in government operations. So with that, our meeting is adjourned.